we'll like to go forward and continue to hear the thoughts of the folks here. We'd first like to have the RAC introduce themselves. We'll start over here with Ken and then just follow around.
Ken Strong, sportsman's rep.
Ben Louder, at large.
Mike Gates, BLM.
Jacob Steele, I represent the Goshute Tribe down by the Deep Creek Range.
Ron Camp, sportsman's rep.
Chris Marble, public at large.
Alan White, agriculture.
Larry Fitzgerald, agriculture.
Chris Schmitz, non-consumptive.
Carl Hurst, sportsman rep.
Dan Potts, non-consumptive.
Matt Clark, sportsman's rep.
Okay, I'm Richard Hansen. I'm an at-large. I'm the chair. We'd like to also thank all the division personnel for being here. John Fairchild on my left, and we appreciate Jenny and Nancy for being here to take minutes of a recording of the meeting. We all have our own ideas about how things should go, how they should, and our own opinions, and we want to hear from each one of you. As you came in, if you're planning on making have a question or a comment on the proposal, you should have picked up a card, and please hand those up here so that we can ask you to come to the mic when that time is appropriate. The meeting will go, the division will make a presentation, and then after that presentation, then it will come back to the RAC. They will have ask any questions concerning that presentation. Then the public will come to the mic and ask any questions, and we want to make sure that you understand that it is a question only at that point. Then it will go to a comment period. The public will then be able to comment on the presentation, and when that is through, then the RAC will deliberate and have comments, add comments that they might have about the presentation. Individuals will have 3 minutes. If you're representing a group, you'll have 5 minutes. And if someone has said, I don't know if that's going to be a problem tonight, but if we have a lot that are basically saying the same thing, if you could just express your support of that viewpoint, you can do it that way also. Next, we need to talk about the last Wildlife Board meeting was
back in 2015.
Yeah, back in 2015. It was in December. They talked about the rule amendment for live lobster. That was presented by Paul Birdsey, and that passed unanimously. Black bear recommendations and rule amendments, Leslie McFarland did that. There was some discussion about that. There was a motion to extend the summer bear season 2 weeks. I can't remember where that went. Did that? I think that passed at that point. And then to allow 2 weeks.
Richard?
Pardon?
That was a motion to make the pre-baiting.
Pre-baiting, I'm sorry. You're right. Thank you. To make that 2 weeks prior to the.
Instead of 1 week.
Right? Instead of 1 week. So we'll be clear on that. Now that passed unanimously. And then they approved the balance of the recommendations as presented.
Actually, there's another change, too. You want me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry to interject.
The other change was a motion to, on the fall hunt on LaSalle and San Juan, to let that hunt continue in September and end on the same ending date as the rest of the state, the rest of the units. However, to restrict hound pursuit during that time.
Yeah, there's quite a discussion about
the hound pursuit. That was the other change.
Okay. And then they talked about the Sheep Rock Mountain greater sage-grouse translocation, and that recommendation was passed unanimously by the board. There was other discussion even about some Mexican wolves, et cetera, and they talked about some of those issues. I want to recognize John Baer, chairman of the Wildlife Board, for being here, by the way. Okay. Okay. We'd like to go ahead and let John Fairchild give us an update. Oh, well, let's approve the minutes and the agenda. Make a motion to approve the agenda.
I'll make a motion to approve the agenda.
Okay. Matt?
I'll second it.
Second by Dan. All in favor? Any opposed? Unanimous. Hopefully you've all looked over the minutes last time. I'll entertain a motion to accept the minutes from last meeting. Ken, make the motion. We have a second. Chris, make. Okay. All in favor? Any opposed? Okay. Minutes passed unanimously. Okay. We'll have a wildlife update by John.
By me. This is an update like for the last 3 months, so I'm going to be here just maybe a little bit longer than I normally would be visiting with you. In our aquatics section, we've had some personnel changes. Chris Crockett has been selected to fill our regional manager position. The Native Aquatics Program is dealing with some vacancies. His project leader position over Native Aquatics is will be announced, and we're still trying to fill the June Sucker Biologist position, and that will be having interviews, a second round of interviews here shortly. At Utah Lake, we've been requesting assistance from anglers and doing some trapping ourselves of northern pike, and it's really an attempt to get a better understanding as part of a USU study, an energy study, food chain study for Utah Lake, see where northern pike are fitting into the picture. Anglers are asked to bring in the fish to the CRO or possibly to the state park. Our Jordan L. Fisheries Management Plan Committee is nearing completion of its work, and we will be meeting again this next month, probably for the last one. We kick-started it a little bit with the introduction of 15,000 kokanee into the Provo River just before it enters the reservoir, and hopefully the surviving fish in 3 years will be running back up that river to spawn. So they will be adding. We will be adding to that 15,000 in the coming weeks. And ice fishing was pretty popular again at Strawberry. Attracted a lot of anglers. And the Facebook post that I saw showed some pretty nice fish. So that was pretty impressive, large cutthroats. In our wildlife section, there's a Riley Peck in the back of the room who's our new wildlife manager. Riley, why don't you just stand up so they can get a look at you? Any concerns about the recommendations tonight, you can direct them to Riley. From the frying pan into the fire, as they say. 19 sage-grouse were moved from West Box Elder County to the Sheep Rock Sage-Grouse Management Area. That's the Vernon area. And another 20 will be moved this week from the Parker Mountain. So trying to kick-start sage-grouse populations in the Vernon area. We had visitors into the Heber Valley this winter because we had winter, and elk found their way back into places where they were not appreciated. And we appreciated the help we got from some conservation organization representatives up there, sitting on haystacks, hazing elk out of agricultural areas. We've got such a mix of land uses up there. It's an elk haven, but it's a sanctuary. You know, it's kind of hard to manage, and this wasn't even a bad winter. So we still have some work to do to get on top of elk management in the Heber Valley. Let's see. Park City trapped 38 elk out of... This is an area where it's very difficult to get a hunt, and we have some year-round elk that are growing. We still have ag uses up there, and so we've got the same problem. Instead of harvesting, we trapped and moved 38 elk from the area around that old ranch road, and most of them went, I believe, to the Sheep Creek in Spanish Fork Canyon. Sand Peak County, again, a normal winter. A lot of new haystacks got visited by elk. Dwayne Maurer was pretty busy, along with Dennis Sutherland. A lot of carryover of that hay planned for sale this spring, and so you have these new stacks that weren't protected. And so every year, it's always a scramble to get to keep up with where people want to put up new haystacks. So that was a challenge. Trapped and relocated 345 turkeys out of nuisance situations in the region and moved to several locations. The Goshutes out at Ibapah got a load of turkeys, Sheep Rocks, Ophir Canyon, Stansbury Mountains, and others. Elk flights involved the Ochre Stansbury and the Deep Creeks. On the Ochre Stansbury, we've documented movement from public land to the private land, mostly the CWMU on the Houston unit on the north end, and that shift from public to private will be reflected in recommendations tonight. Bighorn sheep die-off experienced on the Stansberries, and that's really troubling. We're anywhere from 50 to 75% of that herd is expected to die off, and hopefully the remaining ones are stronger for it. It's the challenge with managing bighorn sheep. Mountain goat management plan is completed on the Deep Creek Mountains. It will be on hold. It won't be shelved, but we're waiting to see how things play out on the LaSalles. The committee to revise the Wasatch Elk Management Plan will convene on the 7th of June, and biologists and others visited 5 bear dens this winter and documented 1 cub, so I can guess that next year will be a good production year, and this year was the off year. In our habitat section, we've got a habitat management plan for the Lake Fork Bird's Eye, Starvation, and Dairy Fork in 2016, and a lot of the work in these plans addresses access and where we're trying to manage access and where we need to protect habitat that's been impacted by user-created roads. A bull hog project is slated for the Santaquin Wildlife Management Area this spring. This is a machine that eats trees, basically, and we're needing to thin out juniper trees and increase forage for big game. Illegal motor vehicle use on the Timpanogos WMA. Anything that's close to the Wasatch Front becomes a playground, and if you don't get on top of it early, it can be a real challenge to manage these areas for wildlife. Let's see. Conservation organizations met today to select habitat projects they want to fund with conservation permit dollars. We appreciate all that you guys do. Thank you very much. I-80 big game mitigation is going to be discussed with UDOT as soon as it can be scheduled. We had several moose hit in the stretch that's been fenced off, and the off and on ramps have cattle guards that aren't very effective. I think the width, the spacing on the cattle guards aren't wider than the hoofs that the moose are accessing with, and they just walk across. So I think you saw one news account, front page, where a lady's the top of her vehicle was completely torn off from an encounter with a moose, and surprisingly she survived. But we did have to put down some moose. We had a real challenge with them in Parley's Canyon this winter. In our conservation outreach section, we held hunter education seminars this February. That's where we train the orient all of our instructors to anything new. Kirk Smith is here. He's going to be talking about some changes. Bald Eagle Day event in Fountain Green was successful. Plenty of eagles to view, and we're getting good turnout for those. We're involved in training instructors for our community fishing clinics, and that's right now a full-time job for Tanya, probably. And participated in a turkey seminar held at Cabela's. In law enforcement, Casey Mickelson from our South San Pete CO district took a promotion as an investigator for our northern region, so congratulations to Casey. Lorraine Hardy is a new CO in Salt Lake. She'll be starting her field training this month. She won't get turned loose on her own for about 3 months, so there's a whole series of situation and activities that that they're exposed to before they are turned loose to work on their own. Posts can only train them so much, then they have to go through the gauntlet of our guys. Annual law enforcement section meeting was held in St. George in March. Great get-together. We had a guest speaker from Wisconsin Fish and Game. Discussed the importance of staying relevant as an agency in the face of societal changes, and we definitely fall into that category also. It is a challenge to keep pace with what's needed in terms of natural resource management, and we're going to find out a little bit about that tonight. So there's your segue. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, John. Board, do you have any comments or questions for John on anything? Okay, let's get into this. Justin Shannon, make a presentation on the Bucks, Bulls, and once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations for 2016.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Justin Shannon. Tonight I'm going to present the Bucks, Bulls, and once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations for 2016. To begin, we'll start with deer. This last year was a really good year for general season buck harvested. We harvested just shy of 30,000 deer in the state, which is as high as we've harvested since about 2000 or so. This graph just depicts the last 10 years. We've had some peaks and some valleys, good years and bad years. This last year was an exceptional year, and really the last 4 years have been really good for buck harvest in Utah. Looking at fawn production trends, again, over the last 15 years or so. What's that?
You're good. Sorry.
Okay. So starting in the early 2000s, took a pretty good dip, and then we came out of it. But the last 7 years or so, we've been between 61 and 64 fawns per 100 does statewide. Buck-to-doe ratio trends over the last 20, 25 years or so. Early 90s, our buck-to-doe ratio was about 7.5 to 8. And then for much of the 2000s, we were hovering around 15 bucks per 100 does. And in the last 4 years, we've really gone from 15, 16 bucks per 100 does to where we're exceeding 23 bucks per 100 does statewide on well, not statewide, general season units that are dominated by public lands. Those yellow lines at 15 and 20, those are really our sideboards for general season units. We manage for 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does or 18 to 20 given the unit. A summary of our deer permit recommendations tonight, recommending an increase of 4,400 permits for a total of 90,950. We do have 29 general season units, and we're recommending no change on 9 units and 20 changes on 20 of the other units. And for buck to doe ratio, which really is what dictates the change on our recommendations, every general season unit in the state is at or exceeding their buck to doe ratio on a 3-year average. We started presenting the recommendations this way last year. We got some good feedback from individual RAC members, so I think we'll try it again until we hear otherwise. I want to break this down by region. So on the far left, you have the unit, and then the objective, what we're managing for, 15 to 17 or 18 to 20. The buck-to-doe ratio for the years 2013, 14, and 15, plus our 3-year average. And then in the second at the far right, last year's permits that the Wildlife Board approved, and then this year's permits that are being recommended. So as you can see, we're recommending 1,550 permits, or a 7% increase on the box or on the northern region. And every one of those units we're receiving we're recommending a permit increase on. For the central region, overall, we're recommending an increase of 500 permits, or 3%, from 16,300 to 16,800. Those increases we're recommending on the Central Mountains Nebo and Oker Stansberry. The Wasatch West, you can make a case that should increase, but we've increased over the last couple of years, and we'd like to see what that looks like for another year before we make any decisions further on that unit. Southern region, a lot of units down there. We're recommending an increase of 1,050 permits, and those permit recommendation increases we're recommending on the Beaver, Fillmore, Monroe, Mount Dutton, Pine Valley, Plateau Fish Lake, Thousand Lakes, and the Zion. And the Plateau Thousand Lakes, that's an interesting unit. What we're recommending is instead of a normal 60-20-20 split in the any weapon, archery, and muzzleloader, we're recommending that 30% of those permits go to archery, 40% any weapon, and 30% into the muzzleloader. It's a small unit, and we didn't want to have the increases go on the rifle hunt. For the southeast region, recommend a 5% increase in permits, total of 700. And those we're recommending on the Central Mountains Manti and the San Juan Abajo Mountains. Again, the 9 Mile, admittedly, it's exceeding its buck-to-doe ratio. It's an interesting unit. All the tops are private, and all the bottoms are public, so adding more permits to the unit may not necessarily result in any increased harvest because where those bucks are summering. Northeast region, we're recommending increases on the South Slope Yellowstone, Wasatch Mountains East, and South Slope Bonanza Vernal units for a total of 600 permit increase. On the Vernal unit, again, we're getting creative with our weapon splits there. We're recommending that 30% of the permits go to archery and 50% go to the rifle hunt. That rifle hunt, they have over 70% success on that, and so we kept cutting permits, and what happened was is we just increased the success rates, killed the same amount of deer, and so want to get creative there and get some of that opportunity back. Moving on to premium limited entry units, these are the Henry Mountains and the Ponsagant. For permits there, we manage to an age objective, and what that is we want 40% of the bucks that are harvested on these units to be 5 years or older, and on the Henry Mountains and the Ponsagant, we're meeting that expectation of greater than 40%. So with that, no change in recommendations or permit numbers from 2015 to 2016 this year. For management buck permits, they're a little different. Those are predicated on a buck-to-doe ratio. So we manage for 40 to 55 bucks per 100 does on these units. And on the Henry Mountains, we're exceeding. We're at 55.9. And really what it really surprised a lot of us. What drove that was 65 bucks per 100 years per 100 does this year, which we really weren't anticipating. And then the Ponsagant's doing really, really well there at 46. And so with that, we recommend no increase on the Henry Mountains, which we understand the plan says we should. That's an interesting unit where it's an antler point restriction and it's tough with a lot of hunters on there. 30s kind of it's a crowding issue beyond that. And so really what we need to do this November is possibly look at a second management buck hunt for the Henry Mountains. So that might be something you see in a few months so we can provide more of that opportunity. And then on the Ponsagant, recommend an increase in 9 permits. Limited entry deer units. There's a lot of information on this table. Again, the far left is the units. Everything's managed for $25 to $35 per 100 does. And really, the take home of this is on the far right is the changes in permits. Those that are highlighted in green, we're recommending increases. Those in yellow, decreases. For the Book Cliffs, really, there's no change in permits for the entire unit. We're just shifting some permits from the south to the north based on the buck-to-doe ratio. That's an interesting unit. For the any weapon hunt, we split it down the middle, north and south. And so permits will stay the same for the total unit, but a slight juggle in the any weapon. And then really an increase on the South Slope Diamond Mountain. They're at $40 per 100 does for their three-year average. So an increase of 12 permits total. For the late season muzzleloader deer permits, this November we added 6 units because they were exceeding $18 to $20 per 100 does, and we're recommending 142 total limited entry permits. So that's kind of where we're at with this recommendation. So overall summary for limited entry deer, we're recommending an increase of 108 permits, most of that occurring on the late muzzleloader season. And it's about a 10% increase. Moving on to elk, general season elk, we're recommending 15,000 spike permits again this year. Last year, the hunter success rate was 14. Anything over 20% success is where we look at a reduction in those permits. On the any bull units, the statewide plan that was just passed by the Wildlife Board in December, that called for an increase of 700 permits, so a total of 15,000. And so that's why the recommendation of 15,000 tonight is to follow that plan. And then the youth any bull permits, we increased it last year from 300 to 500. Got some really good feedback. Hunter success was good. We were happy with it. And so, again, recommend that stay the same for this next year. Moving on to limited entry, recommend a decrease of 142 total permits, or about a 10% decrease. For our 7.5 to 8-year-old units, recommending a 13 permit decrease in these age objectives, and that would occur on the Beaver East and the West Desert Deep Creeks. These units on the far left that have a star at the end of their name, that indicates a change in age objective from the last plan. So we raised the age objective on the West Desert Deep Creeks from 4.5 to 5 to 7.5 to 8. And moving on to the 6.5 to 7-year-old units, kind of all over the board here, recommending increases on the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek, Central Mountain, the Monroe and the Southwest Desert. I'm sorry, not the Southwest Desert. The Book Cliffs Bitter Creek and the Central Mountains Nebo, and decreases on the rest of the units except for the South Slope Diamond Mountain for a total reduction of 164 permits. This is probably where the most change occurred. A lot of units came into this 6.5 to 7-year-old unit, so a lot of these cuts were anticipated. The Southwest Desert's an interesting one. The last several years we've got really, really aggressive with harvest there because we were exceeding the average age so heavy. And this last year we really got into them, and so we'd like to back off of those increases that we've proposed in years past. For the 5.5 to 6-year-old units, overall recommending an increase of 35 permits on the La Salles and the Wasatch Mountains, and a decrease on the 9 Mile Anthro and the Oker Stansberry units. And for our 4.5 to 5-year-old units, again, everything's increasing or decreasing. On the North Cache, recommending a decrease in permits and increases on the other four units up there. But overall, for this age category, it comes out to 225 total permits. Moving on to pronghorn, overall we recommend a decrease in 33 permits, most of which would occur on the Parker Mountain and the Morgan Southridge unit. But a lot of our smaller populations, a lot of our desert populations, southern part of the state, southeast part of the state, are doing really well. And so there's actually pretty good increases in those units. But overall, 33 permit decrease. And then finally, our once-in-a-lifetime units. For moose, we're recommending a slight increase of 3 permits, increase of 16 bison permits, mostly on the Book Cliffs portion. And then desert bighorn sheep and Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep, recommend an increase of 1 on each of those units and a slight decrease on mountain goats. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Justin. Board members, any questions? Chris?
Justin, could you talk about the general season buck permit increase, 4,400? Can you talk a little bit about kind of in general or broad view, kind of how did you come to those numbers? Is that aggressive? Is that conservative? Right in the middle? Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Probably depends the unit more than anything, but I would say overall it's probably conservative to fair. I don't see us being overly aggressive on any of the recommended units that we had. So.
Yeah. Okay. I guess what I'm getting at is, would you prefer to, if you were to just run the raw calculations, would you have come to a higher number or about the same number?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, how it
works. Or are there other considerations to get to that number? You know, do you want to be a little conservative or?
Yeah, I'm probably more comfortable talking about each unit because the way this works is, from the Salt Lake perspective, we look at the data, we generate the data, the regions take a look and say, oh yeah, we're over objective, so we need to increase. And the way that really what we're trying to do is make progress towards these opportunity units. If you'll remember, maybe 10 years ago or so, we went from 97,000 permits down to 95, and then from there we just continued to hack away at it to where we got down to 85,000 permits. So pretty good decreases in permits, and it was always the intention that as permits were decreased and deer populations did better and buck-to-doe ratios increased, that we would recommend increases when that day came. And I would say more than anything, if you look at the data on some of our general season, we've probably had cases over the last several years to increase based on trend, but we really haven't done it until we said, okay, let's get there. And in some cases we did. You know, a trend was just overwhelming and we were exceeding, so we'd increase some permits. But really, if you look at the state of our general season units, there's a lot of opportunity to be had that we didn't have probably 5 or 6 years ago. So, is that fair? I don't know.
No, that's
okay.
Any other questions? Carl?
We had quite a few units, elk units, change age objectives.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? And then also, we've all heard about a potential die-off on the 9 Mile sheep unit. Uh-huh. And we're not cutting tags there. Can you talk about that? And you mentioned, or Mr. Fairchild mentioned a die-off on Stansberries.
Sure.
And we're keeping those tags the same, so.
Okay, there were three of those. What was the first one? One more time.
9 Mile and the elk.
Okay, I'll start with the elk. Yeah, the elk one, if you remember in November when we came through the racks, we proposed a new statewide elk plan. And that elk plan set the age objective for all these units. And some of them made a lot of sense. Like the West Desert ones really was coming from this rack where we'd heard in the past, hey, let's work better with our neighbors on that unit. They're managing for higher age objective. We looked at it and said, this makes sense. So that's one where we had an increase. The South Cache unit, that's another one that took a pretty good cut in permits. But again, as we did the elk committee and as we listened to the public, one of the things we continually heard was, we don't really have a quality elk unit in the state, really above I-70. It seems like you got to go to southern Utah to get into these 7.5 to 8-year-old units or 6.5 to 7-year-old units. And so that was one that we looked at and said, let's have the South Cache adjust. So a lot of those discussions took place through that planning process. And now we're just adding permits accordingly is what we're doing now. 9 Mile bighorn sheep, you're right. There was a lot of concerns when we went and met with sportsmen in November, December, and talked to bighorn sheep and attended the banquet. And that was the one thing that continually came up is we're really struggling with that. And what we did is it wasn't the year to fly, but the biologists went up and did a spot check, hit some canyons that they had seen a bunch of bighorns in the past, and things really didn't look horrible. I mean, we'd lost some lambs, Sorry, I always get these confused, fawns, lambs, calves, when you, and it doesn't help when so many eyes are on you. But, yeah, we'd lost some lambs, and that certainly caused a concern. We're going to fly the entire unit this year, and we did cut a couple permits on the 9 Mile. I don't think we got overly aggressive with it because there's still a lot of rams. I don't think guys were saying we're out of rams. They were saying we're not seeing lambs. That was the biggest thing, and sheep were just not in some of the areas they had. Also, we'd had radio collars on, and so the radio collar data, the survival rate data, didn't indicate major die-off. And so that's why we're still being conservative. We'll know more this November when we fly. And then Stansberry's, was that the third one?
I think we were three and we're staying at three.
Yeah, yeah. The last time we surveyed the Stansberry's was 2012. And again, really conservative on permits. One reason we were is as we start these new bighorn populations, and the Stansberry's in 2012 relatively was still a young herd, and so we just wanted to ease into it. And then we really didn't have good data from 2012 to current. We kept seeing here and more rams, and I know Tom had seen more rams out there, but we'd also had some sheep dying of blue tongue and some other things. So we're just like, let's get some good information before we ramp it up. This year we flew prior to bighorns dying, and the data looked really good. And I think had we not been experienced the mortalities we're experiencing now, you would have seen a major increase in permits. I mean, this is generally the time that we do this when a population's about, you know, 9-10 years old like this one is, and things have developed and matured. And so, yeah, it's really unfortunate because I think a lot of hunter opportunity is left on the table because of these mortalities we're seeing. So, okay.
Matt.
Justin, what do you attribute the increase in buck-to-doe ratios or overall deer populations in general?
Yeah. What do I attribute it to?
Yeah. Why the increase in population and buck-to-doe ratios?
So buck-to-doe ratio is really a surrogate to give you an idea how your herd is doing. If everything is staying stable, if the harvest is the same, your populations aren't increasing or decreasing, everything's static, and you have your permits at the right numbers, you should see the same buck-to-doe ratio year after year after year. But what we've seen the last 4 years, and I'll show it more on the next presentation, we've grown a lot of deer in the state over the last 4 years. And when you do, you know, these fawns that are coming up, they're at a 1-to-1 buck-to-doe ratio. And so what that does is that gives a boost to your buck population. And so generally when your buck-to-doe ratio is increasing like we're seeing, it's a really good indication in most cases that your deer herd's increasing because you're getting this influx of bucks. And so what's driving that, I think there's a variety of things. I think we've had really favorable winters. I think we've got precip at the right times of year in the growing seasons in the spring and fall, which are important. Many pockets of the state were starting to get monsoonal moisture, which has been really good for deer. And also these habitat projects have really started to take. There's other factors, highway fencing, predator control. It's been a huge investment, and I think it's something that we're really excited about. I think as sportsmen and the division, we've been seeking this for a really long time, and it's kind of fun to see it develop.
Ben, excuse me.
Justin, I've got a couple questions for you. I noticed on the Ponsagant management tags that we are about right in the middle on the objective, but we've got a pretty good increase on those management tags. Just wondering why the increase there.
Yeah, it's one of these deals where several years ago we were about 75 management tags on that unit because that unit is just so much bigger than the Henry Mountains. It's a really large unit. What happened was that buck-to-doe ratio was mid to low 40s for quite a while, and so we'd cut permits and cut them. We got them down to 16, as you can see. And, where we saw 49 this year, and we liked the direction of where that population's going, we felt like we could increase a little bit more opportunity because of the popularity of those permits. And so that's, you know, when you're within those sideboards, you have flexibility to increase or decrease on this. You know, that's just kind of the range you can be with. And we felt like 9 permits wouldn't have been that big of an issue given the opportunity that's sought after on that unit. So.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Next question on the Southwest Desert. Our 3-year average is well above objective, but we've got a very hard downtrend, and I'm seeing no change in tags. Should we be concerned there? And
I'm
sorry,
deer or elk, I'm sorry.
Sorry, deer.
Deer,
yes. Should there be any concern for potentially dropping some tags there due to that sharp decrease in the buck-to-doe ratios?
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, we went from 29 to 25 to 19. One of the issues with the Southwest Desert is it's really tough to get good classification data. We seldom hit 400 does, which is really the magical number that we want to get. And in hindsight, really what we should probably do is treat the Southwest Desert more like we treat some of the units in the central region, where we just, you know, we look at that and say, it's really hard to get a representative subsample to tell you what your buck-to-doe ratio is doing. Do I think we lost 10 bucks per 100 does down there? I think it's more a function of sample size more than anything. So, if you guys think it's an issue.
So no real concern from you then for needing to decrease there?
No, I think next year, you know, we'll spend a little bit more time out there. And if we feel like it's, you know, 25, 19, low teens, certainly then there's something to be said there. But we've been in the 20s for a long, long time on that buck-to-doe ratio. And really the outlier there is the 19, if you look at the history of that unit. And a few years ago, we went from 700 permits to 750, and I don't think those 50 permits drove that thing into the ground. I think the 19 is likely the outlier.
So. Okay. On the late muzzleloader deer hunts, what's the success rate been on those?
Oh, I looked that up. Actually, I might have it here. Yeah, so on the Morgan, 7 of the 9 hunters harvested. Camas, it was 50%. Pine Valley, 7 out of 8. 9 Miles, 7 out of 9. Zion, 10 out of 10. Southeast, that's funny. Did I do that? Because Southwest Desert is really what it is, but 2 out of 3.
So pretty good success rates. Do you have any kind of indication as to what quality of bucks are being taken on those?
No, I didn't go through and look at that per se and say what was the width, what was the antler point. I went and read all the comments because it's 46, and really, really good feedback. The one thing that they continually said is, I wish you could be later in the rut. I mean, certainly our plan doesn't allow for that, but and I get it. If I drew that tag, I'd want it to be later in the rut too, but people had a really good time, and a lot of these guys burned double-digit points to obtain some of these tags. Really not a lot of negative feedback, which is why we felt like we could amp that up a little bit once we got that information.
And the reason I ask about that, I didn't know what those success rates were, but I've been looking at the 9 mile, and I know you and I have talked about this. Our buck to doe ratios are very, very high on that unit, but we're not recommending an increase in tags there because of the private lands.
Yeah.
And I know what was your recommended increase on the late muzzleloader?
It was from 10 to 20.
From 10 to 20.
I think it's because we made a commitment when we did these recommendations that we were going to start out slow, and we wanted to do what we can to honor that recommendation. But you're right, and even I think the biologists would agree down there, even if we had more than 20 late-season muzzleloader hunts on that unit, it wouldn't be an issue to us because it's just such a difficult unit. All the tops of those units, mountains, are private, and so adding more public hunters may just frustrate people. You have such limited areas to go. So.
Okay, and then my last question, I'm not sure if you want to field this or if it'd be Riley or Tom, but I've got questions about the ochre. I've had some comments and discussions about the ochre Stansberry General Deer and some concern over the increase there. More so about the private lands issues there than the numbers of deer. Wondering if we... If one of you could speak to that.
Should we make Riley really nervous?
Tom stood up. He seems interested.
You can work Riley over next.
I'll work
year.
Him over after I get done with this one. What's your question?
Well, the concerns that I've had, we've all received a lot of emails, but specifically on the Oak or Stansbury, that's where I probably one of the few units I've received specifics about, and people concerned about the tag increase and crowding issues due to the amount of private ground on the unit, inaccessible private ground.
Well, the Stansbury's is mostly forest, and BLM, there's a few parcels of private, and so that's pretty well wide open. The Oakers has always been mostly private, and so it's kind of a flip. You got about 80% private on the Oakers versus 80% public on the Stansbury's. It's always been that way. As far as the numbers go, hunters being crowded and stuff, there's probably fewer hunters now than we had when we had regional caps. That was one of the things that I've seen a big difference is I can actually say how many hunters are out in the unit. If you went back to the regional caps, we probably had quite a bit more and a lot of folks coming daily out to the, from the Wasatch and hunting the Oakers and Stansbury, especially in the evening. So I don't see the crowding issue, and the private land has always been that way. Probably fewer people. Now we have people that aren't familiar drawing the tag and coming out, and they probably are running into some of that. But overall, I don't see any real issues.
Yeah, and based on what you said, I'm guessing that the concerns I've heard were probably on the Oaker, and the, some of the comments I'd heard is that it gets a lot of pressure because it's close to Salt Lake. But
with a certain private landowner in Ophir Canyon, and that's been blown up over the last few years with access issues.
Okay.
We've solved some of that with the walk-in access. However, that may be an issue sometime in the near future if an easement or it's a trust. If that should take effect, then that might affect some access issues in Ophir Canyon in particular. And that's where most of the people go that have access to a good chunk of BLM ground. It's a pretty good sized canyon. We get a lot of people in there, a lot of pressure. It's kind of what kind of moved the elk out of there, which is where everybody used to go to hunt. That's been a bit of an issue, but a lot of recreation, a lot of pressure going around. So it's moved the elk around, but the deer right now we still have probably better access there right now than we had in the past. With the walk-in access.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Any other questions? I have a question for Justin. Do you have success rates for each unit?
Yeah, not off the top of my head, but we certainly have them. I know statewide what the success rates were, but if you have a question on a unit, we can certainly pull it up for you.
Yeah, what's the statewide average?
For archery this year, it was 22%. For muzzleloader, it was 34%. And for rifle, it was 42%, which is really, really 42%. Above average on
deer?
For deer. Are you talking deer?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. That scared me. I thought I'd give you all these random numbers.
What's it been in the past? I mean, 42% seems pretty high to me right now.
Yeah, in the past, you know, when I first came on and started looking at the big game numbers in the late 2000s, we had units that were in the high 20s. Statewide, we were probably about 30, maybe 33% for the rifle, and everything was lower. I mean, muzzleloader was low 20s. Archery was teens, really low teens. So, I mean, these success rates have been really good. And so, I mean, if you break that down and say, so if we have the same success rates next year, for every 100 permits we're increasing, we're really harvesting 36 more bucks on each of these units, which, again, goes to the early question about how conservative some of these recommendations are. So.
Okay. Any other questions?
Just fewer permits.
You know, I see these management tags, you know, for elk and deer. What do you consider a management tag? I mean, I was just kind of wondering, is it 3x4, or what do you consider management tag?
It's 3 points or less on one side. That would be considered a management buck.
So how do you guys keep track of that then? Do the people come in to show that, or how many people are really honest about killing a management?
We check in everyone.
They check on everyone?
Yeah, and it's, if you look at the numbers, they're not, the amount of management buck permits that we have are really low, 30 and 25. And so within 2 days of harvest, you either have to come to a division office. But generally, I used to work this on the Henrys, and we would stay down there, and our law enforcement would, and we would check every deer on the mountain in most cases, and so that way hunters didn't have to come to our office.
So the bulls then are considered management. How you do that?
We don't have any management bulls.
You don't do management bulls, just the deer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions? All right. Okay, any questions from the public? Come up. State your name. Come to the mic. State your name. Fill out a card for us, too, please.
Well, for comments, you don't have to. Questions.
Questions, I'm sorry. You're okay.
So my name is Jeremiah Grant. My question just really specifically relates to, if you could help me understand the data that's been collected and what the plan is. Mm-hmm. I think I have a bit of understanding what it has been, but what it is going forward relative to the antlerless elk permits that have been, I don't know what they've been, 400, 4,000, some huge number up here in the Wasatch Mountains. In particular, where I hunt is the White River area. I've hunted that for 6 years. We spend a lot of time up there during the week. Full hunt, we get off trail. Yeah. I mean, all the things that you'd want to do to see a lot more elk. And all I know from personal experience is that area has been decimated. Sure. It's night and day different from what it was 6 years ago.
So I want to answer your question. The next presentation is all on antlerless harvest and strategies. So I'm not trying to put you off.
No problem. I'll sit down and listen.
We'll talk about the Wasatch and some strategies.
Thank you. Any other questions?
My name is Roy Hampton. I got a question for Justin. Your tooth data. Do you reach out and try to get 100% on that 2-3 turn? Does everybody get a tooth envelope is what I'm asking.
Yeah, so you're talking limited entry deer and elk. And
just elk.
Yeah.
On tooth data.
Generally, what we do is when that permit is sent, there's a tooth packet sent with it. There are some challenges. In the past, we've had issues with addresses and things like that, but it's our intent to get as much of that information back as we can.
The reason I asked that, I didn't receive one, and I had a bull tag, so I reached out and got the envelope, but I had to request it.
It should have came with your permit. I'd be surprised. You got your permit and not the tooth packet?
Right. Yep. It was a special tag. It was an expo tag, so I don't know if that made a difference.
Maybe it was personal, Roy. Maybe they just.
Ben thinks my wife threw it away, but
I don't know. I don't have a good answer for you. But I know as we issue these out, we send them together, because we want that data as much. So, yeah.
Could you tell me what the 2-3 turn on the Wasatch was? You know that's where I'm headed. So.
Yeah, I don't have that off the top of my head. Can we look that up? What's that? 70%. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
My name's John. I have a question. A lot of emails about this, and a lot of people are concerned about me being one of them, about some of these units. How big of a step do we take towards that objective? Mm-hmm. And if we move, so the question I have for you, if you said you feel like most of these numbers are fairly conservative.
Yeah.
Is there a risk in moving fairly conservative, which I'm okay with, is there a risk in moving fairly conservative if we get a bad winter? I mean, what's your opinion on stockpiling bucks for a rainy day? Can we do that to some degree? Are we going to, if we get a bad winter, are we going to lose them all and we didn't hunt them while we had them? I mean, are we better off hunting them while we got them? Are we better off carrying a few over, hoping the winter don't get them and stay above our objectives? You see, you see the question?
Sure.
Or do we run the risk of wasting those deer if we don't hunt them?
I think so. I mean, you look at the spirit of a general season unit, it's not to stockpile bucks. It's to provide opportunity. And so if we have years where we're at 23 bucks per 100 does, and say we do get a hard winter, and we will. Anyone that studies deer populations know they increase and they decrease. And so when we're on these highs, I think it's best to take advantage of those hunting opportunities because we won't always have highs. And I was a hunter before I was a biologist. And if I knew that we were at 23 bucks per 100 does and I didn't have the opportunity to go afield and I stayed home because even though we were exceeding, I think personally I'd probably have some frustration with that, knowing that it could have been a great year to make a great memory with family and friends on some of these hunts. I mean, it's a really good time in Utah right now, and we shouldn't shy away from that. It's been great, and it's really what we've wanted and worked hard for so many years. And so we cut opportunity in the past, and if we have conditions to provide some of that back at a reasonable rate, I think we should. So. Okay.
Sorry. If we get a bad winter, I guess is what I'm asking. If we get a bad winter, could we go from 22 bucks to 16 bucks per 100 does in a year? I mean, is that a possibility, or are we going to, even with a bad winter, are we just going to see a small decrease?
No, you can't.
I guess. I mean, what's the risk we're running by carrying excess deer?
I think when deer start competing with each other, when you start carrying excess deer and you have a bad winter, yeah, you could lose bucks and you can lose hunting opportunity. How far that goes, I'm not sure to speculate on that, but yeah, you could lose deer in a hard winter. Yeah.
I'm Chuck Hammond, and I had a question on how you guys do your game count, because me, I'm on unit 16A, which is the Nebo. And I was wondering if you guys just go count like on the north part, and then do you factor in like, so say on the north part you find 14 deer per square mile, do you just type that in the system, and then that's what it says is on the south part, or how do you guys do your game counts?
So yeah, great question. So what it is it's a game, it's a deer classification. We are counting, but more importantly, we're classifying. So we're saying, is it a buck, a doe, or a fawn? And you know, if Dennis wants to speak to the Nebo, he can. But I'll speak in generalities. If you have a unit, what you do is you go out there during the time of the rut when deer are concentrated on these winter ranges, and that way you can get the most accurate buck to doe ratio when deer are congregated during breeding season. And what you do is if you have a unit the size of this computer, you want to hit winter ranges here. You know, you want representative subsamples throughout the entire unit. We don't cherry pick and say, well, I think we'll hit the northeast corner of the unit because better conditions or better bucks. You go throughout and you do that year after year, hitting the same areas with the same conditions, and that helps us understand trend a little bit better. The other thing we do for it, not so much counts, but knowing are the populations increasing, decreasing, or staying the same, is we put radio collars out on a lot of deer, does and fawns, and from there we can get survival estimates, and they say, yeah, our deer populations are doing well in this unit because we really haven't had very many die. Does that help you at all?
Yes, okay. And then this is the second part of my question. So me and my family, along with Ken Cleggs, I don't know if you know him, he's a biologist for the CWMUs, we did a game count from about Levan South, which acreage-wise is 43% of the 16A unit, and this consisted of an entire year of counting bucks, does, fawns, because we are concerned about it, and we flew 30 hours out of a private helicopter counting deer because we feel like that part is just kind of left out, And we came up with the number of 1,100 deer on 43% of the NEBO unit. Mm-hmm. And granted, that is the dry part. But, I mean, there were areas not 10, 15 years back where you could go out and you'd see 70 to a, you'd see 70 does in just one single afternoon. And now you'll go out and you might see 5 in a whole day.
Sure.
And this is on like 600 square miles. It's not just on one small spot. And me personally, I've never seen a wildlife biologist in my entire life there. I'm not saying that they've not gone down there, but I've lived there and I'm in the hills constantly and I've not seen one. So I was just kind of curious on how you did that. And that was my question. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Chris?
I thought maybe, Justin, I'd give you an opportunity here to maybe give him a little bit more information on his question. I thought maybe there was an opportunity. I don't know what the harvest is on the NEBO, but if you look at the way the equation works, you take into account harvest as well, success rates. So if you only had 1,100 deer and only 20% of them are bucks, you're going to have roughly 200 bucks. But if you harvested 200 bucks, you'd hardly have any the next year except for your fawn recruitment. So part of the counts, harvest is included in that. And so
harvest is a good checker. I mean, when we do our population models, harvest is certainly taken into account.
Right.
For those data, yeah.
Right. I just wanted to make sure you knew when they do the counts and that sort of, when they extrapolate that number, how many deer are on a unit that harvest is considered, and the continued buck-to-doe ratio trends give you an idea of what's there, if that makes sense.
Yes, but my question is more like, how many of those bucks are coming off of the north end? Because there's not hardly any shot down on the south end. And
it's true.
I've talked right. to tons of people, and I haven't been able to send it to you.
Yeah, I can't answer that. But,
yeah. Dennis, you want to take a crack? I don't know the unit well enough. So.
Well, you know, first off, we manage the whole unit together and try to get a good sample all the way around. And so, you know, we don't want to really separate subunits within our unit. And so you got a good point that there is fewer deer on that south end of the NEBO. I remember back in the days before you were born when you could go from the band to Gunnison and count 5,000 deer.
Okay, that's exactly my point.
But now I might get 100.
And
it's a factor of habitat, really. You're being encroached by the junipers. When the juniper stand gets thick, there's nothing that grows underneath it, right? It's just bare ground. And so it's a matter of just maybe trying to incorporate some habitat projects to bring back the deer.
Okay, so there's been about 25,000 acres worth of habitat stuff done in that park, and the deer continue.
Well, wait a minute, though. You know, when you do a habitat project, especially for big game,
yeah,
it might take 10 to 15 years to see good results. So you just have to be patient.
And keep letting the deer go down.
Well, the unit as a whole is well above the objective of buck to doe. It's, you know, our objective for the NEBO is 15 to 17 bucks per head of those.
Highway 20 is really bad.
He's going to talk. He needs to talk to the mic.
Okay,
so we can get it all over here. And right now the 3-year average is 19 bucks per hundred dollars. So they're doing better than what you think, I think.
I'd just like to say on that too. I mean, that's where I live too. And that's where I've hunted ever since. And I can tell you that south end of that unit is horrible. It's absolutely horrible. It hasn't seen an increase in deer in the last 30 years. Easy. The north end has. No question that it has. And I don't know exactly what all the problems are. John said, you know, we have a lot of highway mortality on that end. There's a lot of deer that are killed on the highway. I'm not sure why they haven't come back on that unit. I can't figure that out either. The habitat seems just as good. 30 years ago, I went down there and planted bitterbrush on a lot of acres myself that the division supplied. So whether or not it's a thing of habitat, I don't know. But I think there needs some attention needs to be paid to that particular part of that unit, because that's historically it's produced a lot of deer in the past. And so anyway, any other questions from the public?
All right, Landon Robinson. My question is for reporting. Is there a chance with our technology nowadays, with our mule deer population and counts, is there a way to feasibly on the computer before you apply or when you're done hunting to do a check that, yeah, I was successful or unsuccessful? Is that something that's possible to get an accurate count on success rates?
You're talking about mandatory reporting?
Yeah, for the deer.
Yeah, there's some challenges with that. So the way that we do our reporting right now is we value randomization. And you're right, we don't sample every hunter. But what we do is we take a representative subsample and try to, on these bigger units, try to get as 20-25% of the people that drew. And from there, we feel like we have really good confidence in what that actual harvest was. We've talked about this very thing. Some of the challenges that are, I don't know, we all have that lazy brother that's never going to put in for his own permit. And so if I got to, now I'm just speaking out of frustration here because it's really mean. But, you know, what do you do when you're putting in for someone else and you're not sure that data? We'd rather have go straight to the source on individuals that drew that permit, yay or nay. There's some real challenges. The other is, we spend a lot of time talking about recruitment and retention of hunters, and you know, the penalty is if they don't know or they don't have the information or they're not willing to give it for whatever reason, then we're putting an additional barrier in from them hunting. And I think in today's world we need less barriers and not more barriers. And so if we feel like our data is good on our harvest, so we're comfortable with it. That helps. So.
Any other questions?
I'm Wes Darche.
What was their name again?
Wes Darche. I just wanted to ask, what age are we looking at overall on the deer, on the harvest data? What is an average age statewide?
We don't pull teeth and age them, so I don't know. What we do have is we have some check station data. Yeah. And years ago, I mean, I would say 5 years ago, a lot of our harvest data that was coming through the check stations were yearlings. It was probably between 60 and 70%, right in there. About two-thirds of your bucks were yearling bucks at 2 points. The last few years, it's been a lot more mature bucks coming through, and that's what I've seen on the check stations I've ran. Biologists, can you? I mean, is that a fair statement? Is that what you guys have seen as well? I have a hard time putting a number to that, but representative, you know, the units that I've helped with check station data on, that's what we've seen is just more 2.5-year-old bucks, more prime age bucks coming through. We just don't pull teeth and cut them on general season units. So.
My name is Jeremy Anderson. Justin, great presentation, and it's awesome to see that the herds are back, are getting back. And if there is that opportunity to give more tags and my son draws out and things like that, I'm all for it. One question I had, though, two items that when you're increasing tags, I wonder how much consideration they got. And number one was the muzzleloader, the scopes on the muzzleloader. Mm-hmm. I think you said that was maybe 32%.
Yeah, 34.
34. We assume that's probably going to go up. I would think it would be anyway. And then the pretty rough winter we just went through, What consideration did those two items, did they have any consideration when we were talked about raising the tag limit?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly things were the winners were certainly concerned on. But if you look at the deer, the buck-to-doe ratios and all this, one reason we went to a three-year average is because, say, the muzzleloader success goes through the roof.
Right.
Or say say we really have we struggle and we lose a lot of fawns this year. What we want to do is build in some real buffers in there so we weren't doing these knee-jerk reactions.
Right.
And we weren't asking biologists to predict the future as to, well, what's it going to be like this fall? So with the three-year average, we're kind of insulated from that. It's certainly something we're concerned on. Yeah. But if any of these if either of those scenarios played out and we're over-harvesting mm-hmm. or we lose a lot of these bucks and our buck-to-doe ratios decline, we could cut permits. We've shown we're willing to do that to manage the buck-to-doe ratio. So, yeah.
And I think that goes back to John Bear's question with, you know, is there enough built in that, you know, if crisis does hit, you know, we're not going to go down to 12 to 1 or something like that.
But John probably should have asked a better question. I better not bite the hand.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, we'll close the question period and open it up to comments from the public. I don't have any cards. Got some, John?
Thank you. It's good to be with you tonight. My name is John Larson with Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. I'd also like to thank Justin for a great presentation. He always does a good job, and I saw this a little prematurely and felt good about it. In fact, as an organization, we support the division's plan and recommendations. We do have a couple of recommendations of our own, though, that I want to talk about. Before I do that, I also want to comment on the deer season. You know, last year was a great deer hunt in Utah, and it is nice to see us on the rise. And I think statewide, that looks really good. We still feel like there's a couple areas where there's opportunity to watch that a little closer, and those are two of our exceptions. And Justin knows exactly what I'm going to talk about, but you got it up there right now. The Manti and the San Juan and Navajo mountain permits there. You got 650, I believe, or 550 on the Manti. I'm sorry, on the Manti, and then 150 on the San Juan and Bajo Mountains in that unit. And, you know, this is a tough one for me personally because, especially on the Manti, we go back and forth several times on this, and we have a lot in the last year and a half that I've been with this organization. And you've been great. You've done us some favors. You've gone to work. You know, you've got that. Now the Manti is a recipient area for urban mule deer, and that's a great thing. But, you know, our sportsmen in that area just feel like that area still needs some recovery time. And so as good as you have been to work with us on that, Justin, we still feel like we'd like to see those permits zero. I mean, no increase at all on that unit, as well as the San Juan Abajo unit, but specifically on the Manti. And then the other recommendation we had is on the elk permits. And we support the 15,000 permits. We think, you know, right now we're well above objective in the state. The only change we'd like to see there is with the youth opportunities. We'd like to see that increase so that 500 we have, we'd actually like to see that go to 800 any bull for the youth. Thanks.
So, John, is that an increase of 300 to the youth?
300. I should have specified that.
I have two comments.
Okay.
I'll do the first.
Okay.
My name is Roy Hampton, representing Utah Bowman's Association. And as far as Bowman's Association, we're in favor of the division's proposals. We really didn't see much of an increase on the deer where it's spread out. I don't think it'll be too bad, and we'll gain some archer tags. So you was in favor of the proposal. My other comment is, personally, I would make a recommendation not to increase the bull tags on the Wasatch. I've been doing this for 4 years. I've been begging not to increase them tags, and I know we're at objective, but in 1998, we was probably killing the same age of bulls as we're killing 18 years later. So I don't know where the top is, we're going to go to 800 tags on the Wasatch, bull tags. That's the most hunted big bull tag unit in the state. You look at the Manti. I'm not picking on the Manti, but for 3 years, there's no increase. They're over objective, not as much as the Wasatch, but and then you look at Southwest Desert. They see a little increase or drop in the age deck, and they drop the tags by 44. And they increase the Wasatch 44. I just think we're over hunting the bulls on the Wasatch. We're gonna get to a point where we're gonna kill, yeah, we're gonna probably kill 5-year-old bulls. And what do you have when you have a 5-year-old bull? He's not what we really want. It's not what I want. But I just make a proposal that we don't increase them tags again. Now I got to give this board credit. Last year, you did vote unanimously not to increase the bull tags. The Wildlife Board ignored your proposal. John did make a motion. I shouldn't say that, but I really believe that if Iraq votes unanimously not to do something, that board should really pay attention to that rack, because it's coming from that region, and the Wasatch is in this region. But I really feel like that we're over hunting that. Where's it going to end? To get to 5'6 or 5'7, that's the age objection. We're at 6'8. How many more tags are we going to increase? It could be over 1,000. You know, I just think there ought to be some kind of limit or some kind of level to how many bulls we want to take off of the Wasatch. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Mike.
Mike Christensen. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the general season deer tags. So you have those age objectives up there for general season units, 15 to 17, 18 to 20. Those objectives were discussed in how many meetings in a mule deer committee setting with multiple interests. I think there was over 20 men on that committee. Then they were presented through the racks, and everybody here and everybody, all the hunters, could come in and have their say on those objectives. And then it went before the Wildlife Board, and they had that discussion again. And then those objectives were adopted into the Mule Deer Management Plan. That plan is given to the Division of Wildlife, and then we hold them accountable with their professional biologists to manage within those windows. So for the Manti, for example, the window is 15 to 17. It's been 19, 23, 23, averaging 21.6. We're 4.5 bucks per 100 does over the management window in that particular unit. Why would we not raise permits and offer the public the opportunity to utilize that resource? Everybody talks about, well, what about this bad winter we just had? Well, that wasn't really a bad winter. The winter's coming up might be a bad winter, and then you lose all those bucks and they go away. They're not there anymore. Like with my herd of cows, I can throw hay to them, and I can sustain them through a bad winter. We can't do that with deer statewide. I ask that you go with the division's proposal, manage the units within the objective that was set forth through the public process. If we get below, or if we see a bad trend below those objectives, I'll be standing here saying, cut tags, we're below that window. So that's what I'd ask that you consider tonight, and thanks.
Thanks, Mike. Any other comments from the public?
Did you recognize Calvin Crandall?
Yeah, I saw him. I was going to do that.
Thank you.
It's Landon Robinson. Oops. I'm shorter, sorry. Landon Robinson, here representing myself, obviously.
over the last little while, there's been a lot of internet talk of things that have happened in the past, and no offense to SFW and the DWR, with past rules that the DWR has set. And I hope that the DWR will follow the rules that they do have. The whole fiasco with the expo, and we'll leave that there. There was rules that needed to be followed that didn't get followed. I hope with this mule deer plan that you guys will consider this and follow it. It's something that was fought over several years ago. We came up with the mule deer plan. We're going to go with a five-year plan. I ask you guys to please follow that plan. For once, let's follow a rule that's been set forth instead of doing a knee-jerk reaction and jump to conclusion and change what we've already been working on. So I believe the mule deer plan was a five-year plan. Please stick with it. I support the tag increase. Along with that, I've heard a lot of, and I don't know if this is the right place to ask this question. It does have to do with the deer permits or the comments, but you hear a lot of the people complain, well, my son hasn't drawn a tag, and this person hasn't drawn a tag in 3 or 4 years, and people are always going to complain and not be happy. But one thing that can happen, and I don't know if you can add this into it or not, is to get rid of the points. If you draw a tag, whether it's your first, second, third choice, because there is a loophole. It's been commented on before, and there's people that are stockpiling points, drawing their second choice because that's what they want to hunt, and they can draw that tag every single year. And so to help kids with getting their tags easier or a family member getting a tag easier, you don't keep your points if you draw. You need to get rid of that loophole. You draw, your points are gone, you start from zero, whether it's your first choice or your fifth choice. That will help a lot of people draw tags a lot easier instead of these people that are 4 or 5 points worth drawing their second or third choice on purpose. So, and then also I support, as Roy Hampton said, no increase on the Wasatch Elk tag. That's been hammered quite a bit. I spent a lot of time out hunting for myself and with family and friends, and 800 is a lot of elk, and I'd like to see it kept where it's at. So those are my comments. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other comments from the public?
Come ahead. I have to have the recorder, do it.
Yeah, you do. Fill one out, just pan it back up.
I just want to echo the two gentlemen that have spoken on the bull increase in the Wasatch.
Jeremiah?
Yes, sir. I mean, I spent a lot of time up there. I have there for 6 years, and it's just, there's no question, and you're hearing it from people that are up there. There's a lot of pressure, and we're going to talk about taking offering several hundred more permits. It seems like it's already been hammered enough.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments from the public? Okay, we'll bring it back to the board. I'd like to say something to begin with here. You know, we have the plans, the mule deer plans, and we have the elk plans and all those kind of things like that. And we can say that the public was involved because they were involved to a certain extent. But when they see increases in areas that they like to hunt, and when they see those permit numbers go up, that's when they really get aware. It's not usually when the mule deer committee's meeting. That's when they get aware. And that's what I've seen is that's the problem. There's a lot of the emails that I got, and I know that everybody here got them, and a lot of them are paste and copy, but I kind of consider the fact that they even took the time to do it as that's what their opinion is, you know. And I think we have to consider all sides of this issue. And I personally believe that the mule deer plan is a really good plan. It's a really good plan. They worked on it hard, okay. It doesn't say they have to do anything except on the bottom end. And I believe that we should be willing to listen to all sides of this and make our determination based on the fact that there are people that are involved that don't usually get involved because they're worried and they're concerned about past history of where our herds have gone before. And that's why they're concerned and worried, and I think we need to consider that. Now, any other comments from the board on the proposal or anything that's taking place? Yes, Ron.
I have just a couple comments. I would agree with you. The copy and paste part, to me, the hard part, I have no idea how many of those are actually from Utah or if we're outside the state since they didn't put any of that information down. So I guess the point that I look at that, I got quite a few responses also, which I know everyone else did too, from people who did put the information down. And so I think we got to take all that in consideration. That doesn't necessarily mean because they were against it that it was actually a populace of Utah that was against it as well. And lots of hours went into that mule deer plan. And the difference of it is that when we set a plan and we all agreed upon that plan, I think any time that you have more people going into an area you love to hunt, that's always going to be a concern. But we also had a concern when those permits were cut down to try to bring the hunt back up when less permits were available for people. So it works. It kind of works both ways. And so you've got to have a happy medium in there. That'd be my comment on that. As far as the Wasatch, this might be a Justin question. I'm assuming on the elk that we managed after 5 3/4 years old due to the population in Salt Lake and having more people have the opportunity since it's close, or why?
Yeah. So, yeah, great question. On the last elk plan, as we were categorizing which units should be managed for quality and which should be up for opportunity, some of the common threads were units that were close to populations like the Wasatch Front, and those that had higher elk populations, so, you know, the Manti being 12, the Fish Lake, the Wasatch. What we were really trying to do as a committee was balance opportunity and quality. And we have quality units in the state, and they seem to be more isolated, but there's a lot of interchange between some of these larger populations, and we felt like the spirit of those units should be managed for opportunity. And you know, if I may, just to touch on that, I know some comments have been made about the Wasatch and not raising it. And Roy's in particular, I think we're good. The one thing he pointed out is, you know, on the Manti, if I can pull it up real quick, when we saw that we were, sorry, one more. On the Manti, when we saw we were at 6.2, 6.1, 5.9, he's right. We did back off of permits. We really did, because we said, okay, we're slowly trending there. That's where we want to be. And you look at, what's the other one? The Southwest Desert there at the bottom, the other one that he referenced. We were at 7.6, 7.6, and we had a major drop at 6.8. And so we are trying to be receptive. Where's the top out on this? I'm not sure, but I don't want to not provide any opportunity because we're afraid of hitting the top. If we hit the top, let's cut some permits. I mean, I think that's how this was intended to work all along. So,
yes, Chris. So I wanted to talk a little bit about some of Mike's comments and some of the other comments made. So when we did the mule deer plan, we did. It's true that we didn't survey or ask every hunter in Utah how they felt about it, but we did take input from surveys that were sent out from the hunter pool randomly, a couple thousand somewhere in that neighborhood. And we also took, the division went around and did 5 regional workshops and took input there at each of the 5 different regions. And they literally took the pages from the notes that they took during those workshops and posted them up around the room so that the Mule Deer Committee could see what the public input was on their thoughts on deer hunting in Utah, and we considered all of that. So I don't speak for every committee member, but I feel strongly that we made a very concerted effort to get a very good cross-section of what Utah hunters wanted out of deer hunting in Utah. And the target windows that we put in the mule deer plan were very carefully crafted to balance out the opportunity to get out and hunt, particularly when we have excess or extra bucks above and beyond those target windows, and when we drop below. And within the recreational goal, within the mule deer management plan, we did put stipulations in there when to increase tags and when to decrease tags. They're very clear and stipulated in the plan. I feel like, you know, in my inbox, I've seen comments from both sides of the argument, and it just took me back to the Mule Deer Committee where we weighed those things out, And I feel like that the plan that we put together was a good balance between, you know, what all the different opinions and the different things that folks want out of hunting in Utah, particularly general mule deer. Justin has said that the estimates or the tag increases are fairly conservative, and I've looked at all angles and considered all different opinions on it, and I feel like that's fair. I think those tags should be available to the public to use while we have the deer, and it's a great problem to have. I mean, I think we're all glad that we're here having that conversation. You know, in the future, when deer populations drop, as others have said, I'll be the first one to say we need to follow the plan and decrease tags. So I think it's critical that we follow the plan. I think the recommendations are within the plan for the general deer permits. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Any other comments? Dan.
Quick question for Justin, if you could come back up. SFW asked for an increase of 300 youth, any bull tags. Do you see any issues with that?
I think they're, if I understand their recommendation right, it was to add 300 to the youth any bull, but at the expense of the any bull permit. So I think it was not to get to 15,000, but to take 300 of those and go to youth any bull. Is that correct?
No, we support the...
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Additional
three. Oh, I apologize. Okay. This isn't recorded, right? So, yeah.
Good luck.
I apologize. It sounds like...
Facebook.
Oh, boy. So it sounds like, if a permit, if we want to increase on the youth any bull by 300, is the question, what's the division's perspective on that?
Yeah.
Our perspective is that we going back to the statewide elk plan, there is a provision in there. One of the strategies says provide youth hunting opportunities where available. We did that last year from 300 to 500, and the feedback we got was positive, and so that's what we were waiting on. I think if it were just the division making the recommendation, we'd probably hold off another year to say, can we get more data? Is this still a good thing? Or hunter success rate's good? We like a lot of information, not just the year to year. But I mean, if there's opportunities to increase youth any bull, and I think we've grown a lot of elk on any bull units over the last 5-10 years in the state, we would support increased youth hunting opportunity, sure.
So you would say there is room for that?
If I were making the decision, would I go with 300? Probably not. I'm okay if we increase. That seems like a pretty hefty increase to me, but I'm all for increasing youth and bull opportunities. So.
And along that line, if I recall correctly, the youth any bull hunts occur. There's some in September and some in November. Is that correct?
No, we did away with the November one.
Okay.
The September ones.
Okay.
Correct.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And then I'd like to take a minute to comment on the general deer proposals. The increase of 4,400. Like Chris, I was on the statewide deer plan committee. We spent a number of hours hashing over a number of ideas and objectives for general season, limited entry season, and the objectives are a range. On our general season, we have two objectives, a 15 to 17 and an 18 to 20, and they are a range. And really the intent there is, if you're within the range, you maintain status quo. If you fall below the range, you cut opportunity to protect your resource and to get back into that range and bring our buck to doe ratios back up. And when you go above the range, above objective, that's opportunity to provide additional opportunity to hunters in the field. And I believe that it is our obligation to manage to that range, to those objectives. The vast majority of our units are over objective right now, and that's a great problem to have. It's additional opportunity that we can provide right now. I understand, and I've been party to all the emails everybody else has. I've had a lot of good conversations, both through email and person to person on the phone. And I've had comments from a number of people that say they would prefer to wait multiple years and have a better opportunity at a better buck, to which I say, great, if that's your prerogative, we provide that opportunity right now. It's called limited entry. But general season is meant to provide general opportunity to the population. And right now we are managing to the plan. This recommended increase is managing to the plan that was passed by the RACs, by the Wildlife Board, went through the public process. I've had people comment to me, well, we need to change the objectives. We need to raise the objectives. This is not the time to do that. The time to do that was when the plan was presented and passed. And the plan did pass with public support, the RACs and the Wildlife Board, and I believe we have an obligation to manage to that plan at this point. Thank you.
Ken. Well, as I sat here and listened to this, and last week I had the opportunity to talk to a few hunters to a group of hunters from Price that hunt the Manti, San Rafael, and also some from San Juan. Both of those groups were concerned about the San Rafael lack of deer down on that area. Now, I know on the Manti San Rafael unit, there's an increase of 550 tags. And I don't think they had a problem with that on the north end, but the south end, they said the deer aren't there. And there's a lot of youth that hunt out there close to town, and they don't have the opportunity to see deer, and they're getting discouraged. Now, I know that John Larson, SFW, suggested no increase on the Manti and no increase on the San Juan. I'm wondering about just splitting that. Those tagged the recommendation of 550 on the Manti and drop that to 275, and the 150 on the San Juan and drop that to 75. And then we just had Justin tell us that maybe 300 youth permits for elk was maybe a bit high, but we could divide that up two to 150 and add it to the youth. My biggest concern is we are losing youth. And if we continue to lose youth, the hunting is going to go down the drain in the years to come. Because we need people that will stand up, that want to hunt, and fight for the right to hunt. And with losing our youth, we're losing that part of hunting and fishing. We're losing those kids that are going to be fighting in the future. So those are things I think we need to look at. Thank you.
Can I just ask him a question? So are you saying that you're losing youth because they're not seeing animals, or?
I think some of it's because they go out. I've talked to some of these kids. I got a grandson who said, I ain't going deer hunting again because I sit out there all day on a mountain and I don't see a deer. And so we really are losing some because they're not seeing anything. We're competing against video games and basketball and baseball and football and everything else. And so we have to some way incorporate this youth into hunting, or we're going to lose them and face it with the different groups who want to do away with hunting. As the hunters get lower and lower, they're going to win their battle and there'll be no hunting.
I guess my argument would be the opposite of that. I mean, if a kid doesn't have a tag, he's got no chance of even seeing a deer or harvesting a deer. And I believe that the biggest threat to all of our passion and love for hunting is the lack of opportunity. Once a kid doesn't draw a tag for a couple of years, they're gone. I can personally attest to that because I've seen it in my own family. I've seen it in extended family. And so if there's an opportunity to increase tags to give 4,400 people the additional opportunity to be out in the wild, every one of us in this room should stand up and say, I'm for that. Because when we cut tags, when we cut opportunity, we're cutting our own throats. If you go up to the legislature, you start seeing legislators who've never hunted before. That's the next generation. We've got to give people opportunity to be out in the field and hunting. And the more opportunity that we can provide for people, the better off we're going to be. So I applaud Justin, and I think you deserve a pat on the back. The DWR gets a lot of guff, a lot of bad rap, and it's unjustified. And I'm glad to see that we finally are at a point where we can increase some opportunity, and I support it wholeheartedly.
Okay. Carl?
And I side on adding more tags. The only reason I have any concern over the 550 on the Manti is our population objective is 38,000, and we're at 25, and it's holding pretty steady, where the San Juan, the other one that we brought up, is clicking up about 1,000 or so a month or a year, and it's getting very close to objective. It's at 11.9. It's at 13 as the objective. So that's... I am pro permits. The only one that caused me any concern was the Manti, because we are still 30% below population objective on that. And so I want all the tags we possibly can, but I would probably support a motion from Ken to cut the Manti tags in half.
There are no doe permits. Right. Just so you know, that's we're talking bucks.
One thing I'd like to say in regards to what Matt said, I've also seen grandchildren go out and hunt for 2 days with grandpa and not see a deer to shoot at and say, I'm done. So there's a balance we have to do here. I'm all for opportunity, you know. I have a really heartburn over this increase, you know. But there's some things we need to do, and maybe we do it through the youth. Maybe we do it through the youth. Give them more tags.
Would those same grandkids go out with you if they didn't have a tag, though?
Yes.
If they said, Grandpa, we don't have tags, but we're still going to...
I mentored a grandchild last year, and we had a blast. Okay. That's an awesome program. Whoever figured that out ought to have a good slap on the back, because that's a lot of fun. That's a lot of fun. And so I'm really, really glad that happened. But they need to go out and enjoy success also, not just have a tag in their pocket. And we need to balance that out. Dan.
Yeah. I support what these guys are saying also, more tags. You know, I don't even care if I go out hunting and pull the trigger anymore. You know, I just want to get out there. And I've put down an awful lot of deer and elk in my life. An awful lot. I think I'm up at 98. That's a lot. Some of them are whitetails, but I cheated. Yeah. I know. I consume. One thing that I wanted to address, though, is that I keep hearing this statement over and over and over again about not having the ability to stockpile. And I want you to address this a little bit, Justin, not being able to stockpile bucks. I really don't agree with that. I think that there's a huge difference in size and ability of buck deer to survive winters, even coming out of the rut, as beat up as they are. So when we've had these catastrophic crashes, you know, averaging about every decade or so, right? These big snowstorms and whatnot. What I've seen is fawns and does literally piled up in the bottoms of draws, dead, where they were stranded. And I go out the very next year, and I'm just astounded at how many of the larger bucks, especially, are still there. I mean, it's like they go through unscathed. Maybe it's because they're operating higher on the mountain, on the windswept ridges, and then they're coming down to get food later on. I don't know. But I'm telling you that I've gone through this stuff of, you know, I'm 62 or so now, and I've gone through these cycles over and over and over again, and I'm just amazed. So Justin, would you talk a little bit about the difference between bucks and does? Because I think the really younger bucks, last year we had quite a few yearlings, as you suggested, and those are going to be two-year-olds now, and I think there's going to be a difference there.
Yeah, so not really sure exactly what to say with it, but I will say this. When you have a hard winter, the most susceptible to loss is the fawns, yeah, because they're not fully structurally developed yet. They're still building or growing long bones and femurs, and they're putting on that growth instead of fat. So when you have a hard winter, that's your most susceptible that you would lose, which is really bad because that's your yearling buck crop that would be coming in. Second would be your yearlings, you know, those animals that, again, still aren't fully developed. They're a year and a half old, and they're still balanced, and should I pack on fat or do some of this other stuff? With bucks, it's just really tough because they have that prolonged rut right before the hardest time of year for them.
So it's a timing thing, maybe.
Yeah, because, you know, you have bucks that let's say this. Every deer loses weight in the winter. I mean, every deer. 20-30% in many cases. But what you have is if you start your winter out with a heavy rut and you're using all that energy and putting that into reproduction, that's extremely taxing on you. And then to follow that up with a heavy winter, they're very, very susceptible. So, you know, when you hear comments that it's difficult to stockpile bucks, it's because their demands are different than the does. The does, they struggle too, but that's more on the back end when they hit that third trimester and they're carrying fawns and some of that stuff. But that's, I think, is what's being talked about with why it's difficult to stockpile bucks.
On that stockpiling bucks, okay, I have a question. The population objective in a unit, okay, if it's way below the population objective, and I assume that that's done and according to habitat, winter range, that sort of thing, on what could survive a normal winter.
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay.
I don't think that is right.
Okay, what is it? What's that objective? How's that based? What's that based on?
I'll give you an example. It's hard to know. I mean, the population objectives were what do we think we can hold, and they were kind of stemmed from the 80s, early 90s, and they've just been carried through in many cases. And we're still learning. I think moving forward, a better way to look at deer is through body condition scoring and have the deer and the population tell you when they're approaching their carrying capacity, when they're more susceptible with these heavy winters. I'm way more interested in those data sets looking at the body condition of deer than I am a number that says this is the magical number we should be at. If you look at southern Utah this last year, one reason for many years our statewide population objective was 425,000. In the next presentation, I'll show that it's now 440,000 because as we hit our population objectives in southern Utah, we didn't go and start calling for doe hunts and we got to keep it suppressed because of this population objective. We looked at the habitat, we looked at the body condition scores of these animals and said, yeah, we feel like there's more opportunity to grow. And so we just simply changed the population objective. I'm much more interested in where we're at now with our current populations and their body condition in the range than I am with a number that may be arbitrary in nature to begin with. And so I think we adjust that population objective and let the deer and the habitat tell us where they can be. Well, is that more fair?
That's the way it's always been.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the winters, the everything else together, they're going to be. I mean, I heard Anise at one point a few years ago say, we're at carrying capacity. This is the normal. And we were like 12 bucks per 100 does. You know, so there's a lot of opinion about that. But I just wondered if that affects whether or not stockpiling bucks is detrimental, as if there's still a lot more room for growth. And so,
yeah, I think in these years where we have grown, it's been really good. And I guess we could say there has been room for growth. But as we do grow on some of these populations, their body condition scores do decline. So can we continue at the rate that we're on now? No, they're going to cycle, and I feel like I'm glad we've had four really good years, and I hope conditions allow for another one. But if they don't, there's that opportunity on the table. And one other point I wanted to make. Oh, the other thing. Nowhere in our mule deer management plan does it say you have to be at that population objective before you can create an increase. And I get that we're not where we want to be on the manti, but we're certainly trying. We've done a lot of habitat restoration work. We've started transplants. I mean, these pockets of in the southeast manti where these sportsmen are talking about, they're right. There's these canyons that don't have the deer that historically they had, and we're doing what we can to try to increase that the deer in those areas. So we are receptive to it, but I just don't think we should wait until we're at 27 bucks per 100 doe or something even higher until we start to chip away at increasing opportunity there. That's all I have on that. So.
Okay, and then one other thing, just on the NEBO, if we increase that by 100 permits, 80 of those hunters are going to be on the North NEBO. Because they will not go to the South. The South NEBO is really bad. And it's starting to become an issue up there, in my opinion, crowding. And so I hope that you can kind of look at that. And maybe we can start some habitat projects down on that south end for these conservation groups, because it really needs it. So,
okay.
Thank you.
The comment period's closed.
Sorry.
We've got to keep moving.
Yeah, we got to go. Okay, any other comments from the RAC? Ken?
I understand what Matt's saying, that we don't want to cut the youth out of hunting. I also know that the deer have disappeared on the south end down on the San Rafael. And maybe the unit needs to be divided. I don't know, but I would suggest if we're worried about the youth, we take it and change it to 275 permits and give them to the youth. And give that many more permits to the youth to hunt down there. That would probably not as many deer would be harvested, but it would be a good opportunity for the youth.
Okay, well, I'll entertain a motion. Anyone wants to make a motion?
I'll make a motion.
Well, let's start with deer and go through that, and then we'll move on to the elk. So go ahead.
Do you want it all at once?
Deer first.
No, I mean all the deer at once.
Yeah.
I'd say if you've got exceptions, itemize them. Do them one at a time.
Okay. I would like to see the manti increase change to 275 and put them as youth permits.
Okay. We have a motion to change the manti to 275 increase on deer permits for youth.
Question on the motion. Do we have a mechanism to even do that?
Yeah.
Do you have a mechanism to even do
that? No, currently, no. The way that the draw system works is you have your lifetime license holders first, and then your dedicated hunter after that, and then these permits get separated out, brought back together, separated out. It's really complex. But then what we do have, and I hope the RAC can appreciate this, is before anyone draws, you have dedicated or lifetime license hunter, dedicated hunter. And then right off the top, the next thing is 20% of the permits are already allocated to the youth. Okay. And that's on every unit, not just this one. And so to throw an additional youth allocation for 275 would be really, really challenging for our licensing folks and the way that the systems are programmed in Fallon to allocate permits. So I don't know structurally if we have the ability to do it right now.
Okay. So, okay.
Then I'll withdraw the proposal.
Okay. Any other motions?
I have a motion that we reduce the permits on the Manti San Rafael to 275.
Reduce the increase.
The increase.
Increase to 275 instead of 550.
Okay, we have a motion. I see a second. Got a second. Okay. Carl? Hey, all in favor? Four in favor. All opposed. Seven opposed. Motion fails.
I'd like to make a motion to pass the permit recommendations per Justin's presentation.
Second by Alan.
Are you asking just on deer or the entire balance?
Just on deer.
Okay. Okay, we have a motion and a second to accept the proposal on deer only. Yes, Chris?
Second.
Got a second. Okay. Okay, all in favor? Okay, looks unanimous. Okay. Pleasure, board. Motion on the.
I'd like to make a motion that we increase the youth any bull elk tags by 150.
Okay, we have a motion.
I'll second.
Second by Ken. Okay, all in favor? Okay, all opposed? One opposed.
How many in favor?
May as well. Eleven, one. Yeah. Okay.
So that finishes on that.
And then
once in a lifetime. Once in a lifetime recommendations. Do we have a motion on that?
Yeah. Yeah, I make the motion that we pass it as presented.
Okay.
It was trivial.
Motion on the once in a lifetime to accept the proposal. Second, Ben. All in favor? Appears unanimous. Okay.
Do we need to do the rest of the elk tags, Richard?
Yeah, we probably. The rest of the proposal. Any motion on that?
I'll make a motion to accept the rest of the proposed elk tags as presented.
Okay.
I'll second.
Second by Ron.
That's the rest of the plan.
Yeah, as presented. All in favor? Unanimous. Okay. Move on to the next item, antlers permit recommendations for 2016. Justin, you're up again.
Alrighty, tonight I'm going to present the 2016 antlerless recommendations for big game. Again, we'll start with deer. I showed this graph in the last PowerPoint, and again, I just want to highlight that the last 7 years or so, we've been about 61 to 65 fawns per 100 does, which has been really good for facilitating deer growth. The one part of the data that I'm probably most excited about year after year is our statewide survival rate data. What we do is we go out and we radio collar does and fawns on 7 or 8 different units throughout the state, and we get them in hand. We collect body condition scores on these things, how much fat they have, what condition they're in going into winter, and then we radio collar them. And what we've seen over the last 6 years is our annual survival rates for adult females has been between 84 and 86%. This last year it dipped a little bit down, a little bit below 84, but still really good. Average is somewhere, you know, about 85, give or take a little bit. And so the last 6 years we've been really good. But if you look at fawn survival, this is really telling. The first 2 years we did this, we were just over 50%. And I would say in the West, you know, average is right around 50. Some years a little less, some years a little more. But the last 4 years, 2012 to 2015, our annual survival rates of fawns has been right around 80%, which is phenomenal. And what that's equated to is a bunch of population growth over the last 4 years, nearly 100,000 deer estimated. What we have is the various years on the x-axis and the deer population on the y. And like I was talking about earlier, we peak, we valley. And right now, we're experiencing a really, really unique peak, something we haven't seen in the 80s for population growth, which has been really great. Population objective has changed from 425 to 440 simply because of the updated unit plans in the southern region mostly. Where we had room to increase that objective, and we took advantage of it. Antlerless deer permits for public draw. We've had years where we've been really aggressive, literally thousands of doe permits. And I'd say the last 6 years, we've really backed off. This year, we're recommending a slight increase from 625 to 755. Those increases we're recommending on the Zion and the Pine Valley units. And these permits are designed to address depredation or rangeland concerns, which is responsible management for deer. Also, we're recommending a new hunt on the Zion, Northwest Zion, and some boundary changes on Circleville North and South. For elk, statewide population trend, late 2000s, early teens, we're really increasing throughout the state. And the last couple of years, we've got aggressive in, with permits in areas that we've needed to. We've gotten more specific and targeted in these where we've had hunts and when we've had hunts. And right now, we estimate that we're just over 79,000 elk in the state, which is about 8,000 elk over our population objective. In December 2015, the Wildlife Board approved a new statewide elk plan and big game rule. And the purpose of this plan was to provide more tools to make progress towards our population objectives. If you remember, one of the changes that was in rule that will be coming about this fall, and it's more of a reminder, you know, the RACs are not voting on this. This is approved. But hunters, I'm sorry, can you keep it down? I'm having a hard time hearing myself. I apologize. So so what we have is with the three elk permits that hunters can obtain for this fall, one can be a maximum one bull permit, one can be a maximum one antlerless elk permit obtained through the public draw, and then a maximum of two antlerless permits over the counter. And so in the past, you could have two permits. One could be a bull, one could be a cow, or two cows. And so now there's more hunting opportunities available. And this will be important as I move forward. So the types of permits we have, the public draw, that's our quintessential. You'll see them tonight. We have a hunt unit. It has a defined boundary and season date. You apply and hope you draw it. And then you have over-the-counter permits. And just a couple examples of these are antlerless elk control permits, which is where you can take one antlerless elk using the same weapon type during the same season dates and within areas of overlap between the boundary, the buck bull once-in-a-lifetime permit, and the antlerless elk control permit. And then we have private lands only permits. Again, this is a strategy in the statewide elk plan that was just approved a few months ago. And these permits that we're recommending tonight would be valid on private property from August 1st to January 31st on select units or subunits using any weapon. And again, hunters must obtain written permission from landowners before engaging in any hunting activities on private lands. So to go through these, public draw, pretty steady decrease in permits over the last several years. What we're recommending for this year is 13,680, which is down from 15,360 from last year. One reason we're doing this is we want to get creative. The new management plan provided biologists additional tools, and so the bulk of our harvest, although a lot of it will still come through public draw, there's new management options which we're excited about that we'll present tonight. We presented it again this way last year, and the regional RACs liked it, and so I'll continue to do it until I hear otherwise. But what we have on the far left is the unit in the northern region, all the units they have for elk, the population objective relative to the population estimate there in the middle column, last year's permits that were approved by the Wildlife Board, and what we're recommending for this year. And so as you can see on the northern region, recommending a slight increase in permits on the cat, and these would occur on the Cache, Ogden, Camas, and North Slope Summit if approved, and then decreases on the Chalk Creek and Box Elder units with two new hunts, one on the Box Elder East and one on the Cache Ridge. In the central region, recommending an increase or a decrease in permits from 430 to 270 with a slight increase on the Nebo from 50 to 100 and a decrease on the Wasatch Mountains West from 320 to 160. And you look at that and you say there's an estimated 3,600 elk on the Wasatch, but we're only issuing 160 public draw permits. What are we doing? And really, the strategy for the Wasatch is changing. You'll see it here in this slide and the one for the Northeast region as well. What the game plan is for the north for the Wasatch is back off public draw hunting because we've hunted these elk really, really hard, and we've heard it. And, in fact, when we put radio collars out this last year on the elk study, it was interesting. During the month of October, when these hunts were really heavy, we had twice as many elk on private land as we did public land. even though there's twice as much public land as there is private land. So our elk were really disproportionately distributed throughout the unit. With that said, recommending new hunts on the Central Mountains Ephraim and Millburn areas, and some name changes on West Desert, Ibapah, and Wasatch Mountains West Timpanogos. What we're trying to do, you've seen these in the past presentations, what we're really trying to do is make sure that every hunt has a unique name and a unique hunt boundary. And so we've got to make some changes on some of these house cleaning items. Southern region, recommending a decrease in permits from 4,250 to 3,730. We just surveyed almost every area, but I think two on the southern region. And, as a whole, the region's under objective for elk. But with that said, we're still recommending increases on the Fillmore, Beaver, Ponsagat, and Panguitch Lake because we're over on those units, and so it's responsible to increase. But we're recommending decreases on some of those other units or staying status quo. Southern region, a lot going on with their boundaries. We're recommending new hunts and boundary changes on the Southwest Desert and the Southwest Desert Northwest part. Two new hunts on the Pavant, three more on the Beaver East, two more on Panguitch Lake, a hunt on Markagunt Plateau, Sandy Creek, and the Ponsagunt. So these are new hunts that are in the RAC packet that Stacy sent out. And then some boundary changes on Kasharam Valley, Fish Lake, Thousand Lake East, and Boulder East and West. For the southeast region, recommending slight decrease in permits, mostly on the 9 Mile Range Creek, San Juan, and Central Mountains Manti, with a new hunt on Farron Canyon East in the southeast part of that unit. And some boundary changes, Moreland Stump Flat, extend that a little bit. And in the San Juan, we're having that align with a boundary that currently exists there as well. Northeast region, recommend a decrease in permits from 3,990 to 3,175. Slight increase on the 9 Mile Anthro, but everything else is a decrease or status quo. A new hunt being proposed on the South Slope Mosby Mountain, and then there's a correction in your RAC packet. In the Book Cliffs, the name of the hunt was Book Cliffs Bitter Creek McCook Ridge, and that should have been Book Cliffs Bitter Creek East. That was my mistake. Over-the-counter permits, we recommend discontinuing antlerless elk control permits on the Wasatch Mountains and the Mount Dutton units. Again, the idea here is trying to reduce some of that hunting pressure on the public lands on the Wasatch and give them a break and not pressure them into areas where they feel like they have to go to private lands. However, we are recommending antlerless elk control permits on the remaining 11 units that we had last year. And also, we recommend 12,010 private lands only permits on 15 different units. So, what does this look like potentially?
On the San Juan and you won't, that's not the San Juan River Venture unit, right? That's the unit
east.
The south.
Yeah. And it's been in Ebol for quite a few years. And we've had this hunt here for as long as I can remember, a long, long time. So. Antlerless elk control permits. Last year we had 8,625 that were sold in the state. And what you can see is when we introduced units like the Wasatch in some of these areas that had elk, that we really had a lot of interest in that. And so, how many of these were going to sell this year? I don't know, but that's why there's a star there by the 4,000. It should be a good reduction. But the private lands only permits, we're looking to amp those up so we can get harvest in some really desired areas. These units on the left are the units where we're proposing private lands only permits. You can see units like the Chalk Creek and the South Slope Yellowstone. We decrease public draw permits pretty heavy in those areas because we want to target that hunting pressure on those areas. And then Wasatch Mountains West, Current Creek, and Aviniquin, which would be important for this rack. This is where we're hoping we get our harvest. We're recommending close to 6,500 permits on these areas, and what we're trying to do is retrain elk. And these areas that elk have sought refuge for so long, we hope to disrupt that. How well is it going to work? I don't know. I'm hopeful. But the division keeps being told, think outside the box, get creative. And this is pretty outside the box for us, and we hope it works. So these private lands only permits, they don't apply to the following: federal, state, Sitla County, or municipality lands. They won't apply to tribal lands, lands enrolled in an elk CWMU, or land where public access for big game has been secured, like a walk-in access property. So in summary, overall, we're recommending an increase in total antlerless elk permits for this fall. However, we're recommending a decrease in public draw permits, a decrease in the number of antlerless elk control units, and we're, for the first time, going to issue private lands-only permits to increase hunting pressure on private lands. Moving on to doe pronghorn, recommend a decrease in permits from 844 to 630. These permit decreases are mostly on the Parker Mountain and the Morgan South Ridge, but there are slight increases on the Box Elder Snowville with the two doe permits and the Centerfield North and Southwest Desert Milford Flat. In addition to that, recommending new hunts on the Snowville, Centerfield North Cleveland, and the Milford Flat area, and some name changes on Mount Dutton, Johns Valley, and Plateau Parker Mountain. Antlerless moose, we're recommending increases in, or actually increase. We haven't hunted moose with public draw permits since 2011 in Utah. And as we've done some survey work and looked at our populations, we're doing good. East Canyon and Ogden both are at or exceeding their population objectives, and so it's time to reinstate some moose hunting opportunity on these units, which is really good news for those that have been at or near max antlerless moose points for a long, long time. So anyways, those new hunts would be East Canyon, Davis, North Salt Lake, East Canyon, Morgan Summit, Ogden, and Ogden West. And that's all I have for antlerless, so thank you.
Okay, board, any questions on Justin? Yes, Chris.
Justin, do you know how many antlerless control permits you sold on the Wasatch last year?
Yeah, I do. Let me... What was that? 539 on the west, is that what you said? For the entire Wasatch, we were... let's see. No, for total permits. Yeah, so on the Vinequin, it was 643. On the Current Creek, 2,029. And the Wasatch West, 2,088. Yeah, antlerless elk control permits. Does that jive with what you guys are... what are you guys seeing back there? That's good? Okay.
So to be clear... we look at the permit recommendations. Let's look at the Wasatch West. So last year we sold 320 permits plus 2,088 antlerless control permits.
Sure.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So this year, at least on public ground, we're only recommending 160 permits.
Correct.
So on public ground perspective, that's a drastic cut.
Yes.
Okay. I just want to be clear and make sure that understood.
I want to be clear about our intentions, too, because I've heard people say, you're doing this to cater to the private landowner, and you're doing these types of things. Really, for those that sat on the Elk Committee with us and those that have sat on the Wasatch Elk Committee, there needs to be an understanding that we're doing this to benefit the public hunter. Because
right.
This year, yes, is opportunity being reduced? Certainly. There's no doubt about it on public lands. But what we've done for so long is applied pressure to these public
right.
lands. They've pushed to private. And we've got to find a way to reverse that. And the only way that we can think of to do it, and we're not that proud. If there's better ideas, great. We'll explore them. But the way that we can think of to do it is find ways to only allow for hunting pressure on the privates and back private land and back off the public land and retrain elk. That's
right.
Kind of our goal, and I hope people are clear on that's the
right.
intention.
And that's why I wanted to ask, make sure it was clear, because
okay.
I've seen that trend, the elk moving. They're there, but they're moving to private land really early on.
Yeah.
In the archery hunt, because now they're trained. This is where we go when we're pressured. So, yeah thank you.
Okay. I have a question. Sorry.
Yeah.
Justin, have you had any feedback from private landowners on this proposal, specifically on the Wasatch?
Yeah. So when we did the Wasatch Elk Committee, there is private land representation on that. And these are some of the ideas that were coming from that initial committee. And then even on the statewide Elk Committee, we had private landowners that were on that as well, and we bounced these ideas back and forth. And for the really, I mean, the way I see it is we're providing more tools to private landowners, because in the past if they wanted to get permits, they have to prove they own land and in many cases show damages and these types of things. And now we're just saying, let's back out of the equation. If you have elk on your property and you have too many then you're willing to tolerate, go get permits and solve some problems. And if you like elk and you want them there, then allow them to be there. But it's really what it does is it empowers private landowners to solve their own problems, which I think is really great.
I guess the way I see it, though, I mean, if you're just you go buy one of these tags, mm-hmm. I mean, how do you just start looking through records of private landowners and start calling them up and saying, hey, can I come hunt elk on your property? Or, I mean, is there any way, any direction from the division on, hey, these are some of the landowners that may be receptive to letting you hunt on their property?
Probably the best way to answer that is when we have like a public draw permit, that is, I mean, any public hunter can benefit from that. I'm not sure that the private lands only permits are going to be for everybody. I almost sound callous saying that, and that's not by design. If I were a private citizen and I wanted to hunt someone's public property and I wanted to approach them, I would probably offer to, you know, can I build fence for a couple days if you give me a couple days in return, something along those lines. I mean, the division isn't brokering any of these communications, nor should we. I don't think that's our role. But it's really to provide landowners the tools to get the harvest where they need to. And if you know someone with private land, great. If you're willing to go and donate time or whatever it's going to be on that private landowner's property and they allow you to be there, that's great too. But I don't know. This is tough. The way we would say it is you better get written permission before you buy the permit. Don't buy the permit and then go try to get the access, because I think we might have some frustrated people. So.
I was going to say real quick too, Justin, on that, access was the exact same question I had as well on that, is what the access is going to be. Let's take it one step further. You have a private landowner who doesn't allow any access on his property. He's got 800 elk on there. Comes to you later and says, gee, these elk are eating and damaged all this stuff. If he doesn't allow any access, where do we come from now from your point of view and saying, hey, whose fault is it that these elk weren't taken care of?
Well, certainly the excuse that we didn't have the tools to solve the problem, that doesn't exist anymore. At the end of the day, we still need to be respectful of private properties and their rights as private property owners, and I think that's all really, really important. Down the road, what we're hoping to do is build on this. If we have a permit in place that's only valid on private lands, I think the next step down the road for situations like this is looking at our landowner incentive programs, our landowner association programs, walk-in access, CWMEs. Are those part of the elk plan says that we need to review and potentially modify them if needed. And so if that's one of the limiting factors for access, then we probably need to write some plans and have some programs that work for today's challenges. And this is certainly one of today's challenges. So.
So I'd like to add just a little bit of clarification that for Matt as well. While this idea is new in Utah, the idea itself is not new. Wyoming's been doing tags similar to this for decades. I've been hunting for the last 10 years on a piece of property in Wyoming where it's exactly the same thing. We buy tags that are good on private land only, and it's simply up to the hunter to work out those relationships with the private landowners. And
doesn't the landowner get something in return?
In Wyoming, yes. So it is a different program. It is a different program, but it's similar still. So, yep.
So just a hypothetical. If I own 10 acres of alfalfa in Wallsburg, and I got elk running through my yard or my property, can I shoot an elk on my 10 acres and offer that to somebody else as they're crossing through? Or is there any parameters on property or anything like that?
There's no buffer zones, so it has to be on private grounds, but we also don't have any minimum requirements. If you have 2 acres and it's in an area that you can discharge a firearm, sure. I mean, we wanted to make it as simple as possible to implement, and it will be something we build upon. And again, this is just this year's recommendation. I don't want to give the perception that because we're going down this road, this is how it'll be forever. We have to give public draw opportunities more. We will reinstate those in the future, but after elk are redistributed, if this works. So.
That's a 5-acre lot.
What's that?
A 5-acre lot.
Yeah, there's no minimum requirements on the acreage, correct? Well, where you can safely discharge a firearm, legally discharge a firearm, I want to be clear. So, yeah.
These permits would be on a draw basis?
No, it's over the, yeah, it's, this is where it's getting confusing because we do have our public draw, and in the PowerPoint I tried to separate it. This is the over-the-counter portion, and so come to a division office and pick up a permit.
So a landowner then could just go into the office and say, I want X number of permits.
Yes.
For hunting on my property.
Yeah, you could have two. You could have up to two over-the-counter permits.
You could have two, and your son could have two.
Correct.
Could have two.
Your neighbor could.
But
have
now,
two.
Would those permits only be good for that specific land?
Any private any property private within land. A unit or subunit, correct. So if the Wasatch West is the unit, and you had property there, and so did Ken, and you guys got along, you could go kill elk on Ken's property. That'd be great.
My turn. So, Justin, just from the private property's owner's perspective, a lot of the reason why, hunters can't, been sneaking along political boundaries all my life, right? No, it's true. But the biggest concern a lot of times is firearms. Mm-hmm. So archery might be the greatest solution to some of this problem, especially on really, really small properties. And then also there's the issue of, address that one.
Yeah, so we went any weapon because if you have a scenario where a landowner says, I'm not comfortable with 270s being shot here, I only want archery equipment being used, so be it. That landowner can allow for that. Yeah, with the any weapon hunt, maximum flexibility.
Let's wait until we get to the public questions, okay?
Hey, any other questions from the RAC? One, Justin, is it, maybe this is not your area, but can that private landowner charge a trespass fee if he wants?
If they want. We won't regulate that.
Okay.
That's between them and the
hunter. Yeah. Okay. Is there any plans to compile a list of private landowners that guys can look at?
Not from the division's perspective, no. I just, the more we've explored that, because it actually came up at this RAC in November, the more we went back and explored that, there's so many complications, and I think in this case it's best to stay clear of it.
Okay.
Justin, just, one more comment. Having hunted the Wasatch for so many years, I really, really think it's going to work. Because it's just minutes before those elk are off to wherever they are. What did Hart Wixom say? These Wasatch elk are just very unique. They don't run 17 miles down into the Ute Indian Tribe's reservation from Chipeta. They run a quarter of a mile into private property, and that's where they stay. I think that this might actually provide some, you're stirring the pot, basically, and providing some opportunity for hunters on public land to now re-engage those same animals.
Yeah,
I think it's great.
I think it's the new wildlife manager, Riley Peck, because the old one, when he was here, man, we had all sorts of issues. But now, new manager, new ideas. I am really excited.
Okay.
Job ready.
You're going to get the credit in any relation.
Okay. Any other questions from the rack? Seeing none, we'll take it to the public. Any questions from the public on the presentation?
I'm Richard Walker, and I wanted to talk about the antlerless control permit idea, and particularly I'm interested in the Wasatch Mountain Unit and how these permits are going to be distributed and how the private land will be managed, if it's like some of the CWMUs, and I've only had a couple of those permits. They actually provide less opportunity. Hunters would be limited to certain areas that are often given access to the poorest part of the private property unless you buy expensive landowner-controlled permits. Another question is, what is DWR going to do with the private landowners to facilitate the level of large numbers of hunters who are coming onto their properties and all the potential problems that that causes? And we all know what those problems are, right? How is DWR going to ensure that there is adequate harvest on the private property? Are seasons going to be flexible enough so that the pressure is constant on private property? And I guess my point is, I think that rather than having this black and white kind of thing where all the permits go to private property, I think that one idea would be to make the seasons a little bit more flexible. I mean, on the private property, you can hunt any time over a four-month period. I understand that. But on some of the private property or on the public property, making it a little bit more flexible and when you can hunt other than just in the open bull season or the buck only season for deer, making it more flexible would probably be better because, and I guess my point is, elk will move to wherever hunting pressure is the least. And they will simply move around depending upon what season is actually open at the time. Permanent behavior changes will not occur without pressure dispersing populations across both public and private lands with more liberal seasons. And so I guess my suggestion is instead of making it black and white with all the 12,000 permits going to private property, divide it in half and allow half of those to go onto private property and half to be on the public land, and then make some of the seasons a little bit more flexible.
Okay, we kind of strayed into a comment period, but he had some questions. I don't know if we picked any of those out.
Go back to the questions.
Okay, but yeah, let's start from.
How will the private land permits be issued? And you partially answered that they're available to the private landowner. He can come in and get some. People will just go in and buy them, hopefully having permission. So how is that going to? Probably the most important question is, what is DWR doing to work with private landowners to facilitate the level of large number of hunters coming onto their property? What are we doing to facilitate it? What do you mean by facilitate? Like to arrange it? Well, so Wildlife Resources is going to be in the process of dealing with all of these problems, you know, people breaking down gates, you know, shooting out of areas, you know, unsafe areas, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah, so livestock. We have units. We have hunts go from August to. Oh, go ahead.
Get that.
If the
hunter does not have written permission to hunt that particular private property, that's an illegal kill. So it's more or less nothing than poaching, correct?
In addition to trespassing.
In addition to trespassing. So all the...
what if it's not posted?
Doesn't have
well, no,
to
that
be.
Does matter, at least for trespassing. I don't know if it would make that illegal.
Maybe we ought to talk about trespass posting for a minute.
Let me have a law enforcement perspective on it, because I've never written a ticket in my life. So how do you deal with trespass? And
unposted,
come on up to the mic.
If it's not posted or not posted properly, certainly it can't be trespassing unless you're asked to leave and you don't. But let's say you shoot it out there. Is it an illegal kill?
Sorry, real quick. Are we hijacking your question session? Let's do this. We will get to that one in a sec. We will get to the trespass one in a sec. But let me take a stab at answering your question, if I may. Your question was, what are we going to do? What's the division going to do to facilitate public hunters coming onto private property, correct?
Right.
Okay. So it would be... Yeah. No different than what we do already. We have hunts that run from August to January on many of our units for many, many big game species, not to mention upland game species, which go even further into the year. This is something that we are concerned with and that we respond to. If we get calls, we respond to them. We investigate a lot of trespassing issues. We investigate a lot of property damage claims, those types of things, and wildlife violations. And so, really, it would be this with the same... methods that we've taken on other hunts and other season dates.
I guess the question is, with those like myself that never have asked. Well, I remember asking one time, you know, seeing elk all over a piece of private property and asking the landowner, "Could I have permission to go in and shoot one of those?" Mm-hmm. And he said, "Sure, for $1,000, no problem."
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of like when I say facilitate, are you going to make those permits, help the landowners to be more open to receiving hunters on their property?
What we're going to do is we're going to introduce the program, which is the private lands only permit program. And then from there, we're going to review incentive programs to see if we can't work out additional public access on private lands. What we really need to do is build the foundation first. And when you're a wildlife management agency and you're making recommendations, you have to make change at a rate that people can absorb. And so we're not doing this all at once. We're introducing the program. We'll get some feedback. And very likely, if these are some of the issues, that public hunting opportunity isn't what it could be, then we'd explore programs to that would incentivize access.
And so if the public doesn't respond well to this because of obvious reasons, limitations, that kind of thing, and you don't get the kind of support for this, then, you know, subsequently you'll look at changing.
Oh, you mean perhaps if the whole thing fails and
falls
on its face?
Well, it's not to the extent that you were hoping.
Then we'd have to adapt like we're trying to do now. I mean, this is an outside-the-box idea for Utah. Ben's right. This works really well in other states, other parts of the West. But, you know, if we can introduce this and we can build upon it and make it better, we will.
Okay. And then the last question is, The elk go basically wherever they, you know, wherever the pressure is the least, and wherever there is enough habitat, you know, that kind of thing for them. Is that really going to, unless you get the same kind of pressure on both sides, it seems like the elk are, you know, the behavior is not going to change. So. You know.
Eventually, that's the goal. But for now, the goal isn't to have equal hunting pressure on both sides. The goal is to have decreased hunting pressure on public land so that elk can be redistributed evenly.
I hope that's the case, but I guess...
And it's short-term. I mean, when the elk get retrained, it's not our... it's not our goal to suppress public hunting opportunities. We're just trying to make public hunting opportunities better, but we're a couple of years out from that. Can I show a slide from a different PowerPoint? Is that okay, Mr. Chair?
Sure. Go ahead.
I want to show something that highlights kind of what I'm talking about and really why we're proposing this, if this is okay. This might be a little unorthodox, but I hope that's all right. So this is the Wasatch unit. Let me grab this for a second. So this is the Wasatch unit, and this is elk distribution on August 10th. 55% of the elk are on public land, 43% are on private land. Okay, and yeah.
The white's the private.
Yeah. Thank you. The white's the private. The orange is the public. In the bottom left, the blue is state owned, and the red is tribal. If you look on the bottom left, it's not showing up very well on this, but public land is 59%, private land is 36%. So keep that in mind. So even before the hunts start, there's a disproportionate amount of elk on private lands. Okay. October 15th, we're in the heart of the spike hunt. We're about to have the deer hunt, and this is with antlerless elk control permits, which have since been pulled off the table if the RAC and board adopt this recommendation. You can see that 60% of the elk are on private, 31% are on public. Twice as many elk are on private lands, even though there's almost twice as much public land versus private. This is the issue we're dealing with. When we talk to sportsmen and they say, guys, you are out of elk on the Wasatch unit, and we come back and say, no, we flew it, and we flew it, and there were elk everywhere. And when did we fly it? In February. Where again, the elk go back to the distribution they had, 53% public, 38% private. So when these hunts start, they're seeking refuge. And do we have all the answers? No. But this is something that we desperately need to do something different than what we're doing now. If it doesn't work, I'll take full responsibility for it, and we will think of a new method to try to get the harvest. But this is in the spirit of what we're trying to do.
So. Okay. And I think that this is, you know, it's kind of obvious for those of us that hunt primarily yes. on public property. We know where the elk go.
Yeah.
But I think there's so many problems inherent with this that there needs to be a lot of homework done before this happens to this extent. And then I would just suggest cutting it in half on private and half public for the elk control.
Can I speak to
Thank
that?
You.
Because to that point, we already have cut it in half. And what I mean by that is if you look at our public draw permits, on the Wasatch unit, yeah, you're right. We haven't cut it in half. Down the road, we will want that balance. But for now, we've just got to back off and make elk feel uncomfortable on private land, make them feel more comfortable on public land.
So. Make it easier for you know, your average hunter to access private properties, and that would make a huge difference. Thank you.
Thanks, Justin. I think it's a great first step.
I'm sorry, what?
I think that's a first great step, what's going on. So, okay, any other questions on the proposal?
I can ask you personally.
Come up to the mic, if you would. Come on up to the mic.
My name is Wes. I just want to ask, what are the consequences of a private tag owner shooting an elk on a public property?
It'd essentially be shooting an elk outside of the unit because it's really valid on private property within a unit. Is that how you'd interpret it? Hey, quit chatting back there. Is that how you'd interpret it?
Say yes.
His question. What did I mean? Okay, you want to answer that again? Or ask that again?
What are the consequences of a private tag owner shooting an elk on public land?
If it's a private lands only permit, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So they're not
thankful
about a valid permit.
Okay. Okay. You guys can go back and whatever. Here it is.
Any other questions? By the way, Calvin Crannell, thank you for being here. He's a board member. Should have done that earlier. Thank you.
Thanks for not making a mistake.
Okay.
That's what we like, active board members.
Calvin Crandall, I want to answer your question, what happens if I don't give permission or if it's not posted? Is it closed if it's private property. What's your take on that? You know, if somebody has a private land, I have private land, it's not posted. Is it considered posted if it's not, if you don't have permission? Does that make sense?
I think I understand where you're going.
On these private, before you answer, on these private landowner permits, you, on your slide, you indicated that the hunter must have written permission. Is that part of the rule, or will it be?
Yeah, so that's exactly what it is. I mean, okay. To hunt private property, you need written permission prior to engaging in those activities.
Okay, so if you don't have written permission.
It's not approved universally, and so he's asking, is that an additional requirement on these
particular? No, that is true universally. If you look at our big game proclamations, that's what it says. It's very clear on needing private or written permission to hunt on private
land. To hunt private lands.
Okay, from a law enforcement perspective, yep, sure. Is my reading of that law consistently says that if it's not posted or not posted properly, absent being an actively cultivated field, that you can hunt it.
Okay. It does say you have to have written permission.
If posted.
You have to have written permission.
So.
You're saying period?
Period, if you're going to hunt. But there's also, you're talking in wildlife violation terms.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a criminal trespass that doesn't, I guess, equate to a wildlife trespass. Criminal trespass states that it's not your property and you don't have permission to be there.
So if you get asked to leave, you have to leave.
Actually, on a criminal trespass charge, that isn't a requirement. Okay. It's not your property, you don't have permission to be there, then you can be cited for a criminal trespass. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
It's if you're hunting on private property, you need permission. You need a written permission.
Yes.
Okay. That's what I need to know. Thank you.
I'm thrown here. But why do we have the clarification in our guidebook that a property be properly posted?
Thank you.
It's always, and maybe it's been taken out and I'm missing it, but it has always said that you have to have the written permission, or you're asked to leave when you don't, or it's cultivated. It also says that reasonably posted, and it used to be every 100 yards that you had to have your property posted. That's been taken out, and because on a large piece of property, they've said it's on the corners, crossings. Well, that's not always 100 yards. And so they've changed that part to be reasonably. That was 2 years ago. Yes?
Gates and waters.
Yeah, gates, waters, crossings, trails, any of that. Does it not say the written permission?
Let me clarify, because I want to make sure we're clear on this. This is what our field regulations say. It says, while taking wildlife or engaging in wildlife-related activities, you may not, without permission, enter or remain on privately owned land that is cultivated, properly posted, fenced or enclosed in a manner designed to exclude intruders, and in addition, you may not enter or remain on private land when directed not to do so by the owner or a person acting for the owner and obstruct any entrance or exit to private property. So that's what it's saying. I mean, there is certainly, if you're a private landowner, you would want your land privately posted. So that way things can be enforced.
So it doesn't say written permission?
But for the purposes of this tab,
yes,
you have to have written permission. Well, that's, I'm asking if there is that additional requirement for this tag, because that requirement, as I read regs, mm-hmm. doesn't universally apply to hunting. I mean, for what you just read, it doesn't.
Hold on. Let me clarify. Permission. Yeah. Permission means writtenly author. I'm sorry. Yeah. Permission means written authorization from the owner or person in charge to enter upon private land that is cultivated or properly posted.
Right. So I think what he's asking is, you're talking about two different scenarios. A public hunter that may have accidentally walked on the private land that's not properly posted is a different situation than this private land's only tag. That's what he's asking. For this tag, are you required to have written permission?
I'm going to say this.
Is that right?
So when would you have a situation where you're on private property and written permission wouldn't be warranted? That's my question.
If you didn't know you were on private property.
That's right.
Yeah, but if you have a private lands only permit and you don't know whether you're on or off private property, you're in trouble anyway. I mean, you get, so to me, let's simplify this. Do what you can do to have private or written permission to hunt private property. I mean, when we put this out, are there kinks that we're going to have to work through? Yes, but we're trying to make it as simple as we can.
So I agree with you on that. I think what he's asking, though, is if there's a piece of private property that is not posted, and you know where the boundaries are and it's private, but you buy a private lands tag, can you go hunt on that property without permission because it's not posted?
What would you do in that case? I don't know what I'd do. I don't write tickets, so I'm not sure.
I'm trying to keep up.
So a piece of private ground, public hunter knows it's private ground.
Yes.
It's not cultivated. Okay. It's not posted. According to what Justin just read in the guidebook, that is legal to be on until asked to leave.
Right.
Because it's not posted and it's not cultivated. So the question, as I understand you asking it, is you've got a public hunter with a private lands cow tag, private lands only cow tag, that knows he's on private ground, but also knows that it's not cultivated or posted, and thus is accessible by the public. Is that a valid instance to use this tag?
Thank you. That's right.
How would you handle it?
Because if it was a general deer tag,
I guess
he's fine. But right, he knows it's on private land. But if it's not, according to what the guidebook says,
requirement under the law.
Right.
The law is it is or it isn't. It doesn't matter if I know. I could not know and still be guilty, or know and not be guilty. That knowing isn't an issue.
It does actually, because if I'm going to charge you with a wanton destruction, which potentially it is, if you kill it.
Well, I'm not getting into wanton destruction.
Well, yeah.
I know where you're going. I'm sorry.
As I say, the knowing and intentional, or reckless.
Okay.
So that's why I ask you. Say he knows he's on private property. How do we know he knows? If he knows and he says, yeah, I knew it, and it wasn't posted, now just establish that you're being reckless.
But doesn't it first start with whether or not it's illegal to be there, which will be dependent on it?
Right now, if he's in and on, it's not privately posted. Now we've got an issue. It's not a wildlife trespass, but it can be a criminal trespass.
Okay. Can we kind of move on here or come up to the mic so we can get this on?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a valid question and has raised some
questions. I agree,
but
we need to have them. We have
issues.
Need to have them at the mic so that we can.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, can I?
Go ahead.
This is a good question.
It is.
We have a lot of meetings yet until we vote on this. For the sake of the meeting, can we move on and we'll look into this and we'll deal with it at the next track and the next wildlife board meeting? I think we have a valid question, but we're beating the crap out of this. None of it's on the minutes and we need to move.
John,
yes.
Recommendation. We have fish and game post everything that's open.
Let's move on.
Okay.
This is what I like about the public process, because it forces us to find answers to questions that we may not have off the top of our head.
Right.
I don't know how I would pursue this. That's why the safest bet is to have written permission.
Okay.
This is something I can look into prior to the board meeting. I just don't have.
It may be something.
When I was prepping, I didn't prep for this.
So. It may be something you could require in rule to go along with these private landowner only permits. It could be.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing in rule right now that establishes them, correct?
That establishes what private property is?
Private land only permits.
It does. Yeah, the rule does say what the... It defines private lands, which is what this was.
Right. But we've never sold them before.
Right, but it does define it. What we didn't get into is, what if it's not properly marked? Because, I mean, these are all...
Let's go.
Okay. Okay. Bring it back to the rack. What's your...
The regs are there.
I think we have the comment from the public. Is there any other public comments on this?
Real quick. Just how much will these tags be for the private?
What's that?
How much will the tags be? So you said you can have two per each private.
Yeah.
Okay, so how much will they be for each one?
Same as a public draw.
For 50 or whatever.
45, 50, whatever that is, yeah.
And then when you do it by each unit, are you going to do first come, first serve?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's how it would be. Yep.
Okay. Okay, let's...
This is what I'm talking about when I say facilitate. What is DWR going to do to facilitate this? Answer questions just like what we've just talked about for the last, 20 minutes.
Sure.
There's going to be a lot of other questions that are going to be asked from especially people like me that are unclear as to, what the rights we will have, how we go about, convincing a landowner to allow us to hunt on their property, all of those kinds of questions are bound to come up. And then there will be the landowner issues, taking care of their property, all that kind of stuff too. So
Sure. Anyway,
there's a lot of questions. It may not be mature enough to proceed at this point.
Okay.
Yeah. I think mostly it's going to be on the person who buys the permit, right? I mean, they're the ones going to have to facilitate.
Yeah.
The contact of the landowner, the whole thing, and that's
what we're encouraging. Have a place to go before you buy the permit.
Okay, bring it back to the board. Any comments? What's your pleasure, Dan?
Yeah, having snuck along property lines that were not properly posted or posted a quarter of a mile off. For intentional reasons. All of these issues that have been alluded to, the hardest part of all of this is actually finding out who owns what. And so I've spent an awful lot of time at the county recorder's office to try to find some kind of contact information. And then, who owns that next door, and on and on. So I think, Justin, that's going to be probably the largest single issue is not, whether you're 10 feet on one side of the boundary or the other side, or whether there's a post that's painted orange or yellow or any of that, but rather just trying to find out who that is and cultivating that landowner. I know that one landowner, I was able to cultivate that landowner by posting, maybe informally, his property. In other words, running around with my GPS and coordinates and trying to figure out where the corners were and trying to spray paint things and things like that. It wasn't formally surveyed, so it was off by what? GPS is off by 20 feet, but that's sometimes good enough for the purposes of that landowner, because if there's somebody a quarter of the mile in their property and they think it's posted well enough, well, then now your CO can do what needs to be done. So I'm just saying that this will work, and I think all of the onus has to go, as was suggested by Carl, all of the onus has to go on the hunter, period. I've been doing it. Anybody can do it.
Let's try to get a motion going.
Okay.
Sorry,
I'll entertain a motion. Chris?
Yeah, I'd like... What's that?
Mr. Chairman, we haven't had public comment yet.
Yes, we asked. I asked for a public comment.
I don't believe you did, Mr. Chairman.
He came up. Okay, we'll go back to the public then. Is there any public comment?
I think he asked that question already.
I did.
There is. Okay, he just didn't hear it. He might have asked it, but he didn't hear it.
He did hear it.
Troy Justinson, representing myself, sat on the Wasatch Elk Committee and the statewide. I support Calvin Crandall's proposal that we do away with all cow tags statewide. Right, Calvin?
What?
Seeing if you're awake. I support the division's recommendations. The thing we got to understand on this is not a hunt to provide opportunity. We sat in there and tried to figure out a way to push the elk back off of private ground, back on the public to hunt. So it's simple. Like you said, Danny, we as hunters have got to take the onus to find out. If you don't know nobody, go hunt somewhere else. It's that simple. But this is a whole key of trying to move the elk back onto the public grounds so we can hunt them. And so we support the division's recommendation. I think it's a great recommendation. I think it's going to work. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. John Larson.
John Larson with Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. We just want to let you know that we accept the division's recommendation. Thank you.
Okay, any other public comment?
You don't have to hear him.
Thank you.
Roy Hampton, Utah Bowman's Association. Utah Bowman's Association is in favor of the division proposals on this.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, bring it back to the rack. Chris.
Yeah, I'm going to make a motion here in about 10 seconds.
Okay.
I think we're overthinking this a little bit, and I think we should resist the urge to rehash all the private lands issues we've hashed out for years. I think there are some great tags, and the intent is good. So with that said, I'd like to make a motion to accept the analyst recommendations as proposed.
Okay. Second by Larry. Okay. All in favor of the... Okay. Appears unanimous. Okay. Let's move on. Kobe Jones.
You were totaled there for a while. I just wanted you to know that.
I was thinking longer and longer.
Oh, we were trying.
Seriously. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now you left as Justin. Now you left
Justin forgot that I get the last word. So.
You can remove it. It was more for fun. I wish I had a picture he had totaled right across the forehead.
That would be quick. I wish I had read it.
Put it on your phone.
That was great. That was so great.
Huh.
A little lev anyway. That was great. Keep that on there.
We'll go back to this now. All right, so I guess I'd start by apologizing. This is the correct numbers in the rack packet. There were a few mistakes that were made, and we've adjusted those and corrected everything. It was in the overall numbers, not in the stuff that's proposed. So it really won't affect today. It's stuff that's already been approved by the Wildlife Board in the past. All right, so CWU permit and voucher review. This is just for antlerless that we're looking at today. The bucks and bulls were already approved in the fall. So we're only reviewing 12 right now that need to be approved. And I'm sorry, 12 that requested changes and 10 that need to be approved by the RACs and the board through this process. Just as a quick summary, and I look at the permits before we get started, you know, there are a lot of permits in the CWU program, a lot of opportunity there, especially in the antlers portion. 1,582 total permits for between does, cows, and doe pronghorn doe deer. And of those, 1,200 are public and 318 are private vouchers. So just a quick rundown, everybody remembers how the split's made. The antlerless split is determined by the buck bull election of the CWU operators. So if they pick 90-10, 100% of the antlers permits go to the public. 85-15, it's a 25-75 split. 80-20, 40-60. And 75-25, it's a 50-50 split. And you see most guys elect the 90-10, but there are quite a few in the 85-15 and the 80-20 as well. Pronghorn is, there are no other options there. It's just the 60-40 and then 40-60. So we'll review this by region. And I kind of wanted to highlight, I went and sent a message out to CWU. I said, let's see what public hunters, so these are all the photos you'll see in my presentation are deer, elk, moose taken by public hunters on CWMUs. So public tags, they got through the draw. It's kind of exciting. There's a lot out there, and it's a lot more opportunity than sometimes we think. Okay, so northern region has the most CWMUs. And the first one there, they just got approved as Junction Valley as a CWMU this last year. And before even one cycle, they requested 5 2-doe permits. They decided they only needed 4 to handle the depredation. So that's 8 possible opportunities for take. And so they asked a decrease by 1. We agree with that. Nothing on this slide that... nothing here. These are the rest are all newer renewals. If you have any questions as we go through. Deseret submitted a request to increase their antlerless elk take by 30. And that's those are all public permits. They did that because they incorporated another CWMU that would harvest about 28 antlerless, and so they just they took on that land, so they took on those permits as well. Twin Peaks Goose Creek, they've had 10 historically in the past. They requested to reduce that by 3, and the reason why is because between Utah, Idaho, and Nevada, right there in the corner, all the states have decreased that population with antlers harvest, so the division agrees with that, the reduction. Jacobs Creek, this is a split recommendation, and I tried to outline this here, but it's a little bit difficult to see. So Jacobs Creek historically had 5 antlerless elk permits. That unit is way over objective. In fact, sorry, 1,500 over objective right now. They requested in the fall an increase in their bull permits. It's an open unit for elk, so they increased their bull elk permits from 10 to 20. And at the time, the biologist let them know that we would ask them to help us with population control, and we'd be presenting an increase in their elk permits as well. As far as I know, that is a split recommendation still. Like I said, they would like to maintain 5 cow permits. And we feel like it's important to do more population control in that area. That's why we're recommending 20. Hardscrabble, another split recommendation. The division is recommending no change and maintaining 15. This is the same unit as Jacobs Creek. So, again, 1,500 over population objective. The division is recommending 15, and Hardscrabble would they're requesting to reduce that by... to reduce it to 7, so reduce by 8 tags. The division recommendation, again, is no change. Middle Ridge, the pronghorn were there in the fields. After 1 year, it became a pronghorn CWMU this last year. After the first year, the pressure pushed the pronghorn out of the fields. They're just not there. So we'd hate to send 10 guys out with antlerless permits that can't fill them. So they asked for reduction, and we agree with that. Schofield East. The opportunity's there. This is the north end of the Manti. We have a hard time getting harvest on private lands in that area anyway, and they asked for an increase of 11. And we recommend approving that. Patmos Ridge. This one was interesting. It's not really a good elk area. It's surrounded by some good elk areas, but we saw this. They came before the CWMU Advisory Committee this last year, and they don't get the elk on them at the right time of year to be able to harvest. And so they asked to take out their antlers permits, and probably will be removing their bull permits this next year too. Not for sure, but probably will be. So we recommend to reduce that to 0, and they agree with that. Rome Cliffs asked for a reduction, and so did Preston Nutter Ranch. Both of these units are below population objective, and so we could see some reduction there on antlerless harvest. Alton, so down on the Ponsagon, they're having more elk move in. They asked for an increased public and private tags. And we agree with that increase as well down there. Okay, as a quick summary, again, we have 9 two doe permits, 5 deer, single deer doe permits, 1,145 elk permits, and 96 pronghorn permits going to the public, for a total of 1,264 permits, public permits on Cedar Muse this year. Okay.
Okay, any questions from the RAC on the presentation? Larry?
Kobe, are you tired? I'm excited.
I'm working on it, Larry. Okay. These last ones took it out of me.
Okay.
Oh, you're done. Okay, any questions?
It's the new soft-spoken Kobe. give him a year, he's going to razz you next year.
Okay. Any questions from the public on the presentation? Mike?
Can't let Kobe off that easy. Mike Christensen, the only question I have is, on the Wasatch CWMUs that hunt elk, are those CWMUs receptive to increased antlerless harvest to move those elk around a little bit like you're trying to do on the other private lands?
Mike, that's a good question. Dale's here too, but he was here. Oh, there he is. He's in the back. Dale, I'll try to speak to this, and if you have something to add. We have pushed those CWMUs and really, really pushed them to take more antlerless tags, and most of them are pulling their weight. I mean, a lot of those CWMUs are 30 public hunters. You know, some have asked for reduction. Said we just don't have the cows with us anymore. So some of them have felt that same pressure as they've applied pressure and just don't have the animals there anymore. But yeah, we push the CWMUs. Hey, we need you guys to pull your weight. We're overpopulation objective. Please help us with this. And the majority of them, I would say, have been receptive. Is that Dale? Do you have anything to add? Is that accurate? He's shaking his head. Yes.
Cha-ching. Any other questions? Okay, any comments from the public on this presentation? Okay, seeing none, we'll bring it back to the board. Any comments? It's your pleasure.
Richard, I'd like to make a motion that we accept the CWMU antlerless permit recommendations as presented.
Okay, we have a motion. Have a second. Ken? Okay, all in favor? Okay, appears unanimous.
All right.
Okay, I don't know who's...
One more.
One more.
You ready for this?
Yeah.
Okay, we have never done this before, but I thought this is part of the process the RACs and the board should see. We have a lot of variance. Well, we have variance requests. In the rule, the CWMU rule, it allows for under-acreage CWMUs or CWMUs that don't meet the minimum requirements. And we see those at the CWMU Advisory Committee. And so I thought it was important to bring those out to the RACs and the board as informational more than anything to know what those requests are and what the division stance is. When those operators show up making those requests. So Missouri Flat and Black Point CWMUs combined to form the Pavant Ensign Ranches. So this CWMU sold. The Missouri Flat CWMU on the Pavant sold. And the same person bought the Black Point CWMU. If they had bought the entity, they could have continued to operate under the Missouri Flat CWMU, but they didn't want to do that. They wanted to be up front, and it was the same group that owns the Ensign Ranches CWMUs in the northern region and one in the central region as well. So they thought they would do this and then apply for a variance. So even though they don't meet the rule because they have 3,400 acres on the mountain that is not contiguous with the other property, although they do have 40,000 acres of contiguous property, so it's not like they're under acreage. They presented this to the CWMU Advisory Committee, and the CWMU Advisory Committee made a unanimous decision to accept the variance request. DWR supports, we support the Advisory Committee's recommendation, and the reason why we support their recommendation is because the Missouri Flat has already operated. They're operating two CWMUs where they have great reviews, and they've done a really good job at it. Or Ensign Ranches has two CWMUs that have done a really good job at it, and then past performance of the Missouri Flat CWMU indicates that there shouldn't be any problems to continue with this one as it is. Okay, so Sandy Ranch came to us with a unique proposal this year. Right now, Sandy Ranch is part of a landowner association on the Henry Mountains where they get a buck deer tag once every 3 years. The Sandy Ranch recently sold, and they own about 4,200 contiguous acres at the bottom here, outlined in red with some of the overlapping blue contiguous acres, and that's split between the Boulders and the Henry Mountains. So the ranch is on both sides. It's about half and half. So they came to the advisory committee with requesting a variance saying they would give up 600 acres on the mountain to public hunters for an exception in allowing them to be a CWMU, an under-acreage CWMU. And they also said that during that time they'll work to acquire some sitla land and some BLM ground, which sounds crazy to acquire federal ground, but the BLM is really interested in some of these other non-contiguous parcels where they've already put it in their plan that they'd be willing to trade other ground. So there is a possibility there of acquiring that ground.
Are these deer?
This is deer. They'd be deer. And probably mostly Boulder deer, more than Henry's deer. So the CWMU Advisory Committee decided, we heard the variance, and there was a motion to deny the variance, but support the CWMU if Sandy Ranch can acquire the additional acreage before the December 2016 Wildlife Board meeting. So they felt like you're walking that line, and the Wildlife Board said several times that 4,999 acres is not 5,000 acres. We all understand that under-acreage CWMUs can operate, but there have been more problems than benefits when we get into these. There's a reason why these acreage limits are set. They're not completely arbitrary. And so the DWR supports the CWMU Advisory Committee in this and feels like if they can meet the minimum acreage and meet the intent of the rule, then we could support as a CWMU, but not until then. There is another variance request on Wasatch West, the Deer Creek CWMU. They would like to become an Elk CWMU. This one was a little different to hear. They currently have 6,700 acres locked up in the Deer Creek CWMU, and with the possibility of reaching 8,200 acres coming over into South Fork. And this one was pretty cut and dry. On an area where we have so many issues with cow harvest and things like that, really, we all know that harvesting bulls, it's great, but it doesn't help with population management. So the recommendation by the advisory committee was to deny the variance, and it was for the operator to go out and work to harvest at least 30 cows on his property to demonstrate that he can cooperate with population management. Also, there is a possibility up there to get 10,000 contiguous acres. It would take some work. There are multiple landowners. Wade Heaton is a perfect example of this. There are 42 landowners in the Ponsagon CWMU. So it takes some work, but you can get it done. And the advice they gave to him was to work well with public hunters, and he'll have the opportunity to do this with the private lands only tags on the Wasatch. It'll be limitless to get people up on there if he wants to do this. And the division supports the advisory committee and committee's recommendation on this. That's Tom's photo. Good job, Tom.
Okay.
There's no action on this.
No action. Okay.
I don't know.
Or is there?
I mean,
I don't know the answer to that.
Was it informational, or do you...
I think there is... Yeah, I'm sorry, John. There is action on it.
Okay.
It's more than just information. At the first I said it was just... It's more than just information.
Okay. Any questions from the board?
Cody, on these properties that are under 10,000 acres, there is a few properties that are close but not quite there. You denied the ones that were not quite the 10,000 acres, correct?
The advisory committee.
But some of these, every acre is not created equally. There is better habitat on smaller, you know, there's smaller pieces of ground that have better habitat than larger pieces of ground. You know, we could have 10,000 acres of desert ground, and 500 acres of mountain ground has better habitat. Are you guys going to work with some of these landowners that do not have quite the 10,000 acres? Or is this part of this private lands only tag? You're going to let them benefit from...
I see what...
You know where I'm going.
Yeah, I see what you're getting at, Larry. And what I would say is that the CWMU rule probably doesn't fit everyone. And instead of adapting that rule and that program to fit everyone, there are probably some other programs in the Landowner Association or some modifications that could be made there to provide those incentives. The concern that you get into with CWMUs is that you don't just sell vouchers. You also provide opportunity to the public. And on small acreages, at times, it becomes very frustrating for guys that burn a lot of points. You know, I saw this with the Patmos Ridge. It just barely showed up. Guy burns 17 elk points, hunted. They hunted hard. They seemed to let him on there for 30 days or more and didn't saw one bull. Saw one elk happen to be a bull. But that's the concern. And you're right, Larry. Not all of the acreage is created equal. But I think instead of the variance option has to be there because there are times when it just makes sense. I think with the Missouri Flats, it just made sense. But if we bend it every time, then the rule becomes invalid too. And so I think, again, this year the division will be looking at the LOA rule, taking a hard look as directed by the board to look at the LOA rule and trying to see where a lot of these units will fit into that and how we can make wildlife valuable to those individuals as well. Is that okay?
Well, yeah, but will you state your goal as your new job to the board?
That's my goal.
Any other questions? Okay, any questions from the public? Okay, any comments from the public on this? Okay, we'll bring it back to the board for comments and any action. Yes, Chris. You're good.
I'll go ahead and make a motion to accept the CWMU variance requests as proposed.
I have a second?
I'll second it.
Matt? Okay. All in favor? Vote unanimous. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, Hunter Education Rule Amendments.
Why did they put them on last? That's
2 years ago, I had the opportunity to follow Justin around. Thanks for breaking them down, wearing them down, so this flies through easily. Mr. Committee, or committee members, Mr. Chairman, Kirk Smith with the Hunter Education Program. I'm the coordinator. What I'd like to present to you is some rule changes as it pertains to hunter education in the state of Utah. Currently, nationally, the Hunter Education Program is guided and steered basically by the International Hunter Education Association. This association consists of all the hunter education coordinators throughout all of the United States. And so we get together, discuss what's going on nationally with trends in hunter education. We also establish the minimum standards that students should be able to know, understand, and do before they go in the field to be a safe, responsible, and legal hunter. Prior to 2014, the IHEA addressed the traditional instructor-led type class was the only type of class they addressed in the standards. And they had set a minimum hour of classroom time of 10 hours. Since then, the online delivery method, technologies, and so forth have really increased and provided opportunity outside of the traditional classroom setting for people to learn about hunter education and hunting. So in 2014, the IHEA established a new set of standards, and they focused on three main topics: safety, responsibility, and legal. That's what we want to be able to produce in hunters as they go out into the field. So the IHEA is looking at a knowledge-based, skills-based, and attitude-based learning opportunity or experience for a hunter education student, rather than the student sitting in a classroom for 12 hours listening to war stories. So the IHEA, what they did is they didn't put a minimum standard as far as hours of classroom. They said it's up to you, the states, to deliver the material, evaluate the student's knowledge base, and determine whether they're going to be a safe, responsible, legal hunter. So currently in the Utah rule, our current rule states that an instructor-led traditional class would be 12 hours minimum length. The online field day, and this is a field day that the students come to after they have completed an online course in hunter education, it's a minimum of 5 hours. Excuse me. And currently we have a shooting proficiency test in Utah, essentially a marksmanship test. We are the last state to have a marksmanship test in hunter education. So as a hunter education staff, we took a look at all of this and went, do we really need to do the marksmanship test? Does that truly make a safe hunter if they can shoot a bullseye day in and day out? They're going to learn that as time goes on. Do we need to take a full 5 hours for a student to demonstrate to us that they know how to cross a fence safely and responsibly and so forth? So what we're recommending with the rule change is to drop the minimum classroom requirement hours on both the instructor-led course and the online course with a field day, and continue a live fire component in our hunter education classes, but just drop the marksmanship test portion of it. We can still have them shoot. We still want them to shoot. We feel that is a very critical component in hunter education, is seeing those students handle that firearm to ensure that they can do it safely. So in the packet that went out, it just basically be cleaning up some verbiage in there and dropping these three requirements out of the rule.
Okay. Thanks, Kurt. Any questions from the RAC on the proposal? Okay, Ben.
Where it says continue live fire exercise, with no marksmanship test, what would that live fire exercise consist of?
What we're proposing right now is to continue with 30 shots. They shoot three position. They would shoot essentially the same course of fire that we've been shooting. One thing that we're where we want to implement in hunter education is have a basic hunter education course that meets the IHEA standards, and then introduce a new type of course that is called extended hunter education. Now, the extended course would consist of the basic course along with an extended opportunity for a new hunter to get some exposure, whether it be shotgun shooting, how to hunt turkeys. We want to work with Wild Turkey Federation, have them come into the hunter ed classroom and take those students from the classroom out onto a shotgun range, do some shotgun shooting, and then out into the field and actually doing some hunting. So what we're hoping to do is partner up with the NGOs to develop this pathway once they're out of hunter education to go on out into the field and get some practical application. So the shooting component, it could actually be with a shotgun. It could be with crossbow. It could be with archery tackle. Just that they demonstrate knowledge and safety and responsibility with that firearm.
Follow-up question, would this change affect the bow hunter education course or the fur bears course?
Currently, this would have no effect on either one of those courses. Where bow hunter education is voluntary in the state, we don't see anything as far as that becoming mandatory, and this would not affect the fur harvester in any way.
Question, no minimum classroom time. We went from 12 hours to no minimum. Explain that a little better, will you?
Okay. What we've put in the rule is that our minimum, our basic hunter education course would meet the IHEA standards. So we have taken the IHEA standards, we've taken our student manual, and we have matched up our student manual to those standards to ensure that they're all covered. We have taken this course and test-driven it, and it's 6.5 hours still. The old videos that... How many in here took hunter education umpteen years ago? Yeah. We're still using the same videos that you watched when you took hunter education. We're looking to get away from those 45-minute videos. Let's get the students out of the chairs and get them up and doing. This is the motto that we use in hunter education. Tell me and I'll forget, show me and I'll remember. Involve me and I will understand. So that's where we want to head with hunter education, is involve me so I do understand. Did that answer your question? We have taken this proposal around to the entire state, to the Corps of Hunter Education instructors. We've had 13 banquets and workshops with them already, rolling this new course out and this rule change, and they're supportive of it.
I have a question. How many hunter education certificates are you putting out a year?
We traditionally run around 10,000 students a year through the program. It fluctuates just a little bit. Now, this graph here, the white columns are the traditional students historically from 2003 to current 2015. The pink, or macho salmon, are the students that have taken the online class with a field day. So we've been following this trend in the state to see what the students want and where they're going. And so right around 10 to 11,000 annually. 2015, we did have a little bit of a decrease in the total number of hunter education graduates, and we attribute that to the trial hunting program. We have had over 5,000 people enroll in the trial hunting program just within the last year. So we suspect that that this number will bump just a little bit as they come back into hunter education?
Yeah, so because our favorite hunter ed instructor, Ray Thane, passed away. No, don't smile. He's awesome. I think he was the first one to start a Spanish speaking program. Has the online part been done in Spanish to try to facilitate that? Because I don't. Or do we have Spanish speaking instructors? Because you know our population here in Utah, especially along the Wasatch Front. Oh my God. You know,
currently here in Utah, with our online courses, our three online courses that we accept, one of those is translated into Spanish.
Right.
It's available narrated in Spanish and also written in Spanish. And that is something that's on our radar, is the Latino community in going out and recruiting Spanish-speaking instructors to actually target that community. So that is on our radar in hunter education to be more available and assist that community.
Yeah, the reason is obvious. I mean, quite frankly, of the various ethnic groups, I mean, Hispanics are just all into hunting and fishing, period.
And Ray Thane was the backbone to the Spanish.
And a great person.
Yes, he was.
Any more questions? Questions from the public? Any comments from the public? Okay.
All two of them that are still here.
Any comments from the RAC? I do have to say this. I got a pretty extensive email from a hunter education instructor from Southern Utah. And he was really concerned with the hands-on thing about the experience for these kids. But I just wanted to mention that. You're probably aware of that. So.
Yes. Our course outline that we're currently teaching until this rule change does not have a mandatory field day component for the traditional style student. And with our course outline, we're going to implement a mandatory hands-on by every student statewide, regardless if it's a traditional or an online.
Okay, thank you. Any comments? Anything more from NARAC? Okay. You want to make a motion?
I would. Good guess. I'd like to make a motion to accept the hunter education rule amendments as proposed.
Ron Camp seconds it. Okay. All in favor of the motion? Motion carries unanimously. Okay.
Way to stay relevant, right?
Thank you.